Well, a very good evening and a very warm welcome back to the Dr. Rock Radio Show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. It's really great to be back, having had the rug pulled out from under my feet for a while there by Mr. Microshaft and his dealings with Skypey. That was, of course, The Clash and Know Your Rights. It'd be really helpful if a lot more of us did, I think. Before that, Mansion on the Hill, going out to Guy Taylor, who I gather is still having the piss mercilessly taken out of him by people who really by now should know better. And before that, the John Preston tribute band and a ruling class. So as I say, on this occasion, it was proved to be a little bit difficult to broadcast for a couple of weeks because Microsoft chose to upgrade Skype 4.2 to 4.3, and in the process, I'm sure, completely accidentally, they disadvantaged all of those of us who like to broadcast on open source software rather than out of Microsoft's finest. Not only did they upgrade to 4.3, but they also retired 4.2 with practically no notice at all. Now, I do remember a time when you could actually load an operating system onto a computer, get used to the way it worked, and actually keep it as long as you liked. It used to just sort of keep working, and you could kind of use the software packages you were used to and not have to disturb yourself really until something went seriously wrong, and then you might choose to change these things. It seems that those protocols have now changed. Even the open source software actually requires upgrading more often than I'd like, and although you can choose not to take these upgrades, sometimes it might impair your security. Sometimes software packages just stop working and something that worked fine yesterday doesn't work anymore. But I think that to actually take a software system that everybody's using and just retire it to force them to upgrade is deeply cynical. And I would like to say to any Microsoft users who are tired of the old Git that really the Linux and other open source software is now working really, really fine. And in a way, I'd like to thank Mr. Microsoft because he forced us all to move on. We've now got a much better broadcaster than we had before. I've got another new Linux operating system, which is much more sexy than any of the ones I've tried before. In 1997, when I started using it, it really didn't work at all. Well, it did, but half of the buttons didn't do anything. Nowadays, there's lots and lots of stuff. And mostly, it's actually pretty easy, you know, to stop using the commercial trash and start using a decent software system. But enough of that. It's probably going to take me a bit of time, and I've got one or two hiccups that it might need, a little bit of sorting out. But tonight we've got a show of recorded material just so I can ease myself in to being back on the air and to playing with my new toy, as it were. And we're going to be hearing from a man called Tamash, who is part of the Avalon Rising crew at the Green Gathering. And one of the reasons I chose to go and listen to him, I did listen to a few people, though we were kind of pretty busy. It was actually much harder to get to hear things this year than before because there was, well, just a lot more going on really. But Tamash, been sharing a field with him for a couple of years now, but this was the first chance I had to actually meet with the man, and I really enjoyed his talk, which is called Shamanic Community Living, which he goes into in a bit of detail. As regular listeners to the show will know, it is my opinion that one of the things that is going to prove pretty crucial to our recovery from the state we're in is our ability to regain our ability to live together, because it seems to me there are many people who think it's impossible that we can do that. There's many people who don't want to try. Lots and lots of people believe that it's absolutely essential for them to have their own front door, as it were. Well, I spent a lot of my life trying to find different bunches of people to live with and trying to find different ways of doing it. My latest and greatest discovery, I think, as those of you who heard the show on the subject will know, is Old Chapel Farm, where there's people coming from all over the world to help look after animals, grow food, make cheese, drink whole milk, drink clean water from the hills, all that kind of stuff. Well, we actually had a visit from the local chapter of the World Management Team's enforcement people today, and there'll probably be more of that in future shows, unfortunately. But Tamash, he's also been moving around the so-called UK for many years, living in communities, some of which I've been to, some of which I haven't. Certainly listening to him, some of them I'm sure that in the future I will go and have a look at. But also he's been abroad He's been over to South America and lived in some communities over there. And he's got, I think, some very pertinent points to make about how communities grow and how they tend to suffer once they've established themselves, how similar difficulties and challenges arise, and the recognition of these challenges, as much as anything, is important to dealing with them. So I want to kick off the first talky bit, really, by playing 50 minutes or so of Tamach's talk, Shamanity Community Living, which was recorded live at the Green Gathering. Now, in times past, in the background of Dr. Rock's interviews, we've been able to hear things like the Earth Heart kind of dance tent banging away, or sometimes bands. This, at the Green Gathering, we're put down the quiet end of things, not a place where Dr. Rock would in the old days have been used to be, and it has to be said, although he quite appreciates it nowadays. None of the music's properly loud anyway, is it, anymore? Too many yellow lights and getting people to turn it down. I don't want you to risk damaging your ears by listening to something that's properly loud. But we did have something properly loud just over the way from the Avalon Rising tent, because we had the children's play area. Now, I think it's really great that children are made extremely welcome and looked after very well at these festivals. And next week, when I hope to have a bit of a slideshow together to show you, I think you'll be amazed by how many children there are kind of racking around the place, happily without their grown-ups, just having a good time. But there is a particular concentrated area of them which has a carousel and various little entertainment tents for them and all that, and every now and then some people turn up dressed as pirates and get the children involved in all sorts of games, and at those points they do tend to make an enormous amount of noise, and believe me, they are much louder and definitely more shrill than the Earth Art dance tent or any rock and roll band I can think of. So old Tamach, who is speaking without a microphone, does occasionally find himself drowned out a little bit by these people, these children. It only happens for short periods at a time, and I still think it's worth the effort of listening to him. The other thing is that I had actually sorted out the problem of the quiet interview, because as many of you will know, it's a challenge I've had before. People ask me to turn it up because it's very difficult to hear sometimes through your laptop speakers or whatever. And we had actually sorted that out. I think the show before last had actually been shown how to make it so that I could turn up the quiet interviews. Now, unfortunately, I would spend all that time actually getting around to sorting it out. In the new installation, I can no longer do that. And I'm sure there is a solution to that, and I only really discovered that it wouldn't work a few minutes before coming onto the show. So I am once again going to have to torture you with a slightly quieter than I would have liked interview. A couple of things about that. If you've got some extension speakers, it probably would be easier to hear. It's probably easier to hear a little bit if you listen to it through headphones. I will try and get something done about it before the next show. Apart from that, I can't say anything, really. It's just, am I ever going to catch up with the technology? Sometimes I really, really do doubt it. Anyway, it's really, really great not only to be back broadcasting, but to be back with enough kind of battery power and stuff to be. I've managed to listen to a few shows on people's internet radio recently. It's really great to have actually had enough reserve power to be able to do that, because up till recently I've just been able to manage my own administration before everything goes flat. But things are definitely improving that way as well. So it's great to be back broadcasting. It's great to be back listening. And any of you that aren't in the chat box and just out there listening on radio players, why not come and join us? There's always some really cracking stuff going on in there. And there are also lots of good videos and some forums and plenty, really plenty of excellent podcasts from previous shows to listen to. Why not come and explore the place? In the meantime, here's Tamach from the Green Gathering, the Avalon Rising tent, struggling against the children's area to do his talk on shamanic community living and how he's found it over his years of searching. I'll be back with you in about 50 minutes or so.
The group is trying to make something in its consciousness. And before I met the community, and I met the community through Big Green Gathering getting cancelled, and this Earth Energies, this Even Marquee, went to the community where I was living in Wales, and they came with a bunch of Colombians, and it was through meeting the Colombians through this tent and through the Big Green Gathering got cancelled, but I managed to get to the jungle and learn a lot of stuff things that, I mean, at the time, years ago, I was reading a lot. I spent a lot of time sort of working in like second-hand bookshops, and I just only went there just so I could read and just filled my head just with, you know, as much new age, you know, like spiritual information as possible. And I can say it from just a few years in the shamanic community and using the plants, I sort of see now just how little I really knew and how little, you know, I still do know. But previous though, I was living in different communities in this country, and I sort of used that term sort of loosely, you know, not necessarily because of the intention of the people setting up the community, but I mean, the first place, it was in North Wales. It's a place, a Centre for Alternative Technology. It started as a community in the 70s, and they sort of had a shared vision. And the shared vision was sort of with the technological side of the society, trying to replace that with renewable energy, like sustainable sources. And by the time I moved there, which was like in the sort of mid-noughties, 2006 or something like this, 2007, it was already like a well-established institute. And but they invited me on to live on site in their on-site community, which I liked. And for me, it was amazing to actually get that, you know, first like foothold into like a community or into living in nature. Previous, I'd always sort of lived in towns and cities, and I found that at winter time I suffered from quite negative states, emotional states, you know, as
we call it La La Land.
La La Land, is it? What, the city or winter? No. So I was living in the cities, and every winter I found myself getting depressed. And this is the first time that I'd lived in the countryside during winter time. And I noticed that we walk like out from where we lived, and there was like a view of a mountain. And I sort of noticed that every day the mountain was getting whiter, and as the snow descended on the mountain every single day, my depression was going with the sense of that snow coming down. And by the time the snow actually came down to the level where we were, I suddenly realised it's not me getting depressed, it's the energies of the land that's all moving off. Because when you're living in a city, you really get disconnected with, you know, the elements, with the etherical realms. And for me, it was quite like a revelation, it was quite healing. I mean, it didn't necessarily heal my depression, but I at least realised that we're all going through it together, you know, and it's actually like the state of the earth itself. And even that sort of one little foothold, you know, into living with nature, into, you know, living so close to like even just like a mountain, it was just amazing how much more freedom and how much more, you know, like how little in control I was of my own emotions. Because when you're in a city and you see the same concrete all the time, it's hard to really, you know, distinguish the wood from the trees. But I sort of felt slightly disillusioned with the community side of it. They'd become like an institution. Everyone had their role, everyone had their place. One person got the firewood, one person bought the food in. It's like everyone had their designated roles. As long as those roles stayed the same, people could come and go. Which at the time I thought was great, but I also felt there was something missing. There was something more about community than just turning it into an institution and having like a set of roles. So the next place I went to, and I was told it was a community and it was a good place, you know. So I went to this place, and there were lots of anarchists who were there, and it felt good. And we're sort of trying to make decisions, and we soon realised that the land itself, it was owned by trustees. And these trustees, they didn't live on the land, but they just wanted things to happen. And if we were like we were their serfs, just literally, you know, we want this to happen on the land. And it wasn't really our vision what we wanted to do. So after a few weeks of being there, I thought, well, okay, this is not really, you know, my vision of community either. This is literally just living as a serf with lords, you know. And disillusioned there, I then went to another community in Devon. And they joined together. They started initially to come together as a community to live on the land, to have their own bit of land, to have their houses, grow their own food. Now in this country it's quite tricky, this situation of living on the land, because the land has been so cut up and designated everywhere that you don't just necessarily have the freedom to just go onto like agricultural land, build a house or to do anything, you know. You learn very quickly in this country that you don't own land. You have the illusion of owning and buying land, but really when you buy land, the crown leases it to you. That land is not yours, it's leased to you by the crown in this country. So if you want to do something to the land, if you want to make an extension, if you just want to treat that land as if it was your own, the Crown is soon, and a council and all our agents are soon going to come in and basically stop the fun or stop the play. And at that stage in the community there, the council had come and said, you can't live on the land, you know, you can't be living like this, you need to justify and explain yourself. And the road they went down was to turn it into a permaculture project. And I'm not criticising at all what they're doing. What they did was absolutely fantastic, you know. And in terms of the legal battle they did, it sort of set a precedent in this country for people to be able to go on the land under that banner. So they went, did a huge mission, which has made the job a lot easier for other people. But also noticed themselves that, and ourselves there, that by having to jump to the tune of the council, we'd have lost that aspect of just living with ourselves, living with the land, living as a community. Suddenly we're a group of people trying to live with the council. And our biggest worry was not how much food we have, where our water's coming from, where our wood is. Our biggest worry was what the neighbour's going to think, what the council's going to think. And that little by little...
What's
that?
Which community was it?
It's Land Matters.
Second?
Land Matters, you know. It's a great place, you know, great people, but because of the pressure, environmental pressure... You know, on that community, it's had to adapt
that's
itself.
The woodland community they mentioned when you took over our woodland.
They took over our woodland there, yeah, as well. You know, it's a beautiful place. You know, I haven't seen it for years, but also I felt quite disillusioned after being there and thinking I'm still not exactly what I want. You know, I'm not like I really knew what I wanted, but I knew that I wanted something that was more than that. So I went to another piece of land where a group of us, we all joined together as well, and it started good. You know, we were celebrating the solstices and the equinoxes. For us, like the focus of our community, our vision was to sort of try and celebrate the Celtic calendar and sort of connect with the Celtic gods or like the Celtic mysteries, you know, by through celebrations, through bringing people onto the land, and you know, and what we felt was trying to awaken consciousness. Now, obviously in this community, you know, we had like certain points, certain, you know, certain ideals that we shared. And I suppose the sort of anchor pins about this community, it was like organic food, recycling, and sort of fair trade, things like this. And using those three as an example, you know, because obviously we get, to, these are like boxes which we tick, that whilst we're living in a society, we think, okay, so we want to be living in such a way that's not causing too much effect on people. So you buy organic. Now, for instance, a lot of organic food you get from China comes from the Yangtze River, or the Yellow River. It's the most polluted river in the world, just raw sewage business river. And along the side of the most polluted river in the world, a great portion of the organic food we're eating came from that river, or came from the basin there. And also, all the scandals in this country of the abattoirs, from their bone and from their blood, they're putting that onto the, you know, into organic farming. So people are sort of buying, I mean, it's natural, this is what we did for ages, but obviously with all the, you know, additional chemical introductions to the farming industry as well, that it's hard to actually find, you know, that same sort of organic practices in this country that hasn't, you know, got that contamination with it.
Unless you're doing it yourself.
Right, unless you're doing it yourself, absolutely. But fair trade, I've recently... Oh, since moving to Colombia, I can confirm that anything that comes from Colombia called fair trade, you're only paying a landowner more money. You're not paying the people who are working. And the landowner who has more money, he cannot be permaculture. That landowner, in order to get a fair trade contract, he has to be monoculture. He has to be, you know, he has to have a certain amount of land and a certain amount of turnover. Like the actual business of fair trade is set up that it excludes small subsistence farmers. If you buy something that says fair trade on it, it's only 1% fair trade that they need to comply with in certain places. So you're only buying 1% of fair trade, and that 1% goes to a very rich landowner. The smaller subsistence farmers, because they're not fair trade, they don't get more money. And so when you're in a region that all grows coffee, one farmer who's richer, who's got all the bigger land, he's getting more money. And the smaller subsistence farmers who can't buy the license, they can't buy themselves into the fair trade cabal. And basically these... end up in debt because there's so much coffee. For instance, in Colombia, there's been a big coffee crisis. All the price of coffee goes down because it's so much. All the little farmers, they owe so much of the money to the bank, so they sell their farms to the fair trade farmer, the fair trade landowner, better said. So he's buying up all these farms, and really, you know, as far as I've seen in Colombia, fair trade is bullshit. It doesn't exist. you know, I'm not saying that all fair trade is like this, but, you know, it's definitely worth trying to find sources that really are trying to help people, you know, like Palestinian olives or anything like this. It probably exists out there, so I'm not dismissing at all, but definitely in terms of, you see something that says Colombian fair trade, do us a favour and don't buy it. Because you're
funding. Something to look within the organisation, because obviously the organisation is set up on completely different principles, isn't it?
Sure,
if you
know.
Bring that to their attention, I'm sure we could make some changes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you do bring it to their attention. They say, you take it to the courts, and once the courts have decided, and we found that the farmers themselves have a corruption at a government level, and we've been trying to take these guys to court for the last 8 years. And the fair trade company just says, take it to court, once they've decided, and the actual level there, because of the mafia and the way the corruption works, you cannot take these people to court. I'm not really want to speak too much about fair trade, but get the point across that we take these boxes to make ourselves feel good. And actually, when you really explore and really get into the details of what's going on, we're actually contributing to the world's demise, even though we're sort of doing it to feel good. And for us, that was like the anchor pin of our community. We wanted to do these things because we felt these were the things that sort of try and help the world. Yeah, I'm not really speaking so much about fair trade. It's more, you know, that we tick these boxes. But really, you know, if we're contributing to our own demise by these like little feel-good factors, what does that say about our own state of mind? Well, yeah, this is the question, because obviously we're in this community, and after a while, you know, we sort of built this community and we were ticking these boxes, we had these roles. And it's only afterwards I left that community that I realised, you know, the whole point of coming together in community is to make consciousness, is to make a point that we get to see our responsibility and our actions in the world. And these other communities, you know, and every single, not just these communities, every group, everything that you set up has this process of evolution, like things just growing up and budding, and then it goes through, if it just left to its own devices, it'll go through involution, as it will just decay and it will rot and it will fall down. And this, when you come together in a group to make consciousness, you go through that natural stage of evolution, it all rises up, and then the rest of the journey, you're in a constant fight for it not to fall down, and against that state of involution. In this country, in the communities, it sort of manifested itself with, you know, the communities being turned into institutions, or being turned into, like, you know, sort of mechanical...
Kind of bureaucracy in a way.
Yeah, right, this is it, you know, like automatic, like a robot. You know, everyone had their role, everyone had their thing that they did, you know. But it's actually, in terms of consciousness, we were quite slack on that. In fact, I suppose in the past, our own understanding was, as long as we're expecting a bit of weed every day, then we're doing our part for, you know, expanding consciousness. So, Big Green Gathering got cancelled 5 years ago, and it was a big attack against, you know, the grassroots movement. Because of that attack, I personally have, you know, it's helped my own spiritual growth in ways that I can't even begin to, you know, begin to describe. And I found that quite an interesting thing, that when you get these kind of big attacks against, you know, the grassroots movements or against the campesino movement, the indigenous, the Indians, that indigenous spirit always finds a way to manifest itself, come back out and become stronger, you know.
Whatever you fight against becomes stronger, and when they bring the fight to you, you become stronger.
Right, sure. Yeah. It's the interesting one about, you know, sort of having some kind of thing to fight against, you know. Because in the other communities, when we didn't have this sort of common vision or even a sense of common enemy, because you hear about, North America, and they say it's necessary for the people can only amalgamate when there's like a common enemy. Because that's what, you know, brings people together. And, you know, and it's very true, you know, if when we do have a common enemy, there is something which sort of binds us together. But if we're also just living, if all of us just went to the jungle and we're just there in the middle of nature, what is going to be our common enemy? You know, it's going to be ourselves, you know, and not necessarily each other, but we all have to take responsibility for our own actions. So in a sense, a way to make consciousness is to fight against the thing inside us which makes us unconscious. It's to fight against the thing inside us which makes us fall asleep. You know, there's that moment between waking and dreaming, or between your awake state and your sleep state, where you can transfer your consciousness into your more subtler bodies. And we have the opportunity to practice that every night. You know, how many days are in a year? How many years do we live? And one day we're going to die. And every single night we have the opportunity to practice for our death. But there's just that moment where we forget ourselves. We forget ourselves, then we fall into sleep, and then we wake up not remembering how that transition went. And yet the death process is very similar to this, that all of it is the most inevitable thing for all of us, that one day we are going to have, you know, our own lives come to an end. This is, you know, if there's anything worth fighting for or worth saving our energy for, is to make that, to understand that transition. So there's a part of us which likes the light and likes consciousness and wants to wake up and likes the ideas. It longs for these things. Also, there's something inside us which revels in the darkness. Something inside us which, you know, would rather be left in ignorance and not have these things woken up. And so, in a sense, there is like a spiritual fight going on in each and every person. A lot of the Vedas, for instance, the Bhagavad Gita, for instance, it starts with a huge war. When Krishna comes in, the battlefield is suddenly split up, and he has to speak to Arjuna, which sort of represents the human willpower. Because Arjuna suddenly doesn't want to fight anymore. Arjuna just, you know, sees all his dynasty, all his relatives, literally split up into two people, two kingdoms, and he no longer has the will to fight or the will to live. So Krishna takes him onto the battlefield, into the middle between the two armies that are just about to annihilate each other, and Krishna instructs him about the spiritual fights and the spiritual war. Now, that spiritual war, in a sense, is something which is happening inside us. It's something between the forces that want to wake up and between the things that want to remain in ignorance. And to explain a bit, you know, what our life is in Colombia, you know, because some people sort of, they see the title Shamanic Community and they think we're all doing yogic poses on rocks and trying to levitate, you know, leaves or whatever. But really, no, most of the time we're just trying to be farmers, trying to grow our own food. And like hand to mouth, especially up there, that we're trying to earn our daily bread by the sweat of our brow. It's not necessarily like we've gone there and we've invented this. It's something which is like quite established in the Latin American culture, and they have it established also the shamanism. And so they have it established. Obviously, it's something which we had here. You know, it's all of us at some point. You know, no matter which race we come from or which mixture of races, all of us have been indigenous. Have been come from like a shamanic or a native culture. In Colombia, you have this sort of phenomenon of indigenous land being robbed, and basically, yeah, Indians being thrown off the land. And just so happens, every time they get thrown off that land, there's gold or there's emeralds, there's oil. And this has been going on under the pretext of a civil war that's been going on for a long, long time. That actually really got established in the 1940s when there was a guy. He was the people's choice for president. And even though he didn't get into the clique with the oligarchs, he basically toured the country and got everyone behind him to be voted in as the next president. And everyone was behind this person, and they wanted this guy, you know, because he was speaking very honestly about the nature of the oligarchs, about the nature of imperialism, and stuff. You can read the stuff today, and it's as much relevant today globally as it is to Colombia in the 1940s. And this guy got assassinated, but the whole country was behind him. So when he got assassinated, it just freaked everyone out. Loads of people ran into the hills, into the jungles, and they started like the guerrilla warfare. During his assassination, Fidel Castro was there, and he got a lot of inspiration and realised like a lot of the tricks of the beast. That's so when he went back to Cuba, he sort of already saw, he already had quite an insight as to like the nature of imperialism and its sort of ugly face, you know. And he was quite successful in Cuba on a small island with a Cuban revolution, but actually in Colombia that has not managed to manifest itself, you know, through the same tactic of guerrilla warfare. And basically what's happened in Colombia, and we're based in Colombia by the way, what's happened there is that the civil war with the guerrillas, they've basically set up kind of like anti-guerrillas, which in a sense are like death squads. So the rich oligarchs and the landowners, they've basically bought in, and they've got private armies. These private armies, usually they're ex-convicts, people have gone to prison. If they don't want to be in prison, then you've got the opportunity of joining a death squad. And this has been like a covert war that's gone on for over half a century now.
By the School of the Americas?
Yeah, sure. And by Mossad as well. There's a big Mossad connection there. Yeah, you bet your life. But, I mean, there's the conventional, you know, Colombian military, and they sort of do things above board that looks fine. But actually, when they want to brutalise an area, they send them the death squads. Now, they will use any tactic they can, just basically go into indigenous land to rob it and to get the people off that land. Under the pretext of civil war, the army will come and say there's guerrillas here. They start shooting across, you know, the people's land, and the people just flee, you know, because most people, they don't want to pick up a gun and kill people. Most people just want to live in peace, especially in Colombia. where, you know, the majority of people just live on the land as, you know, just peasant farmers. So civil war comes to people, they flee that land, and then that land is suddenly up for sale. They've sold vast tracts in the river to China, they've sold the mestizo areas to other big corporations as well. And basically Colombia has become the state of the civil war, has just meant they've gone, sliced the country up and sold it all off. There's very few areas left, which are the sort of native areas, you know, deep, deep jungle, very, 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 very high mountains. The same thing happened in this country in the Civil War, because there were more indigenous, native, witches, wizards that got killed during the Civil War in that decade than any other decade. That's pretext of the round, you know, the roundheads and the cavaliers. It was just a pretext for robbing land and for killing people, for genocide, you know. But we get taught it today as if it's the, you know, parliament versus the king, you know, and it's not. It was genocide under that pretext of civil war, and they're using the same tactic in Colombia. And the result of this is that you get a lot of people who are displaced indigenous, or people who from the land, and they've had the land robbed off them, and they either go into the city or they have to reform and create new communities.
That's exactly what has happened in this country as well. All these people in cities and towns being dispossessed of
land. This is what we are. We are displaced indigenous from our own land, you know, robbed of our birthright, you know. But we're so robbed of it, and the culture has been so built up that we don't see the injustice of it. You know, we're sort of born into it. But in Colombia, because these people have still got the strong connection with the land, the people still feel this injustice. So a community is, you know, a mixture of displaced, it's all displaced indigenous people, predominantly Colombians, but also, you know, English people there as well. And it fled the jungle, you know, it was a community that sort of still had its roots in the jungle, and it was working with like shamanic plants. Does everyone know or understand the concept of shamanism, or, you know, we're on the same page? And if, or better said, does anyone not understand the concept? I can see these guys. Okay.
So?
Yeah? Okay. So just when I say that, I don't want people to not know what it is and I carry on speaking. If there is something which you don't understand, just raise your hand, you know, and if there's something which you need clearing up, you know, feel free to ask. So, in this community that sort of came from the jungle, it was using the shamanic plants, which in this country is called ayahuasca. There it's called a different name, yahay, in Colombia and in Venezuela and Ecuador. It's got a lot of different names, but in Colombia they call it yahay. And this plant is visionary, that when you take it, it produces like an illness inside you, or it makes you vomit. And it's not the plant itself that makes you vomit. The plant goes into your bloodstream and it puts all the toxins into your stomach, and then you vomit up the things inside you, like the heavy metals, the heavy substances inside you that you pick up through breathing, or, you know, through other, sometimes you, substances are in your body because of certain sort of psychological states, and when it goes to your stomach and you vomit that up, it doesn't necessarily free of that psychological state, but it frees you of the thing which anchors it in your body, and then you have to look at that psychological state. So it's quite a magical process of basically cooking this medicine. You've got a big pan like a cauldron, you're having to put a fire under it. You can't let that fire die down. It has to be at a certain temperature. It can't boil over. It can't boil under. If you know the stories in this country of Taliesin and other stories, this is, you know, it's the same like Celtic myths, which they're doing there in South America. And this tradition, they're having it deep in the jungle in sort of region, Amazonas region of Colombia. And they were getting visions, and they were getting indications that they would have to make a connection with the Western world, specifically with Europe and with this country. So they changed the land, they bought a bit of land somewhere near the road, and there they started meeting a few Westerners who came. And they brought some medicine back here, about 15 years ago, since they were making ceremonies here. And little by little they built up enough money to then bring the shaman here. And the vision which took him, brought him here, was that whilst he was there in South America, in the jungle, he was drinking this medicine, he saw a vision of the ancient ancestors of the jungle folks with the ancient ancestors of the Celtic Albion folks in this country. And he saw this energy bridge, you know, sort of like a bridge of light that went from Albion to the jungle. On this bridge of light, he saw like the ancestors of both lands coming up on this bridge, and they were meeting each other. And in spirit, they were like brothers, you know, they're like a spiritual brotherhood. They both wore white. They both lived in the woods. They both had devotion to nature, and they both knew a lot of like high elemental plant magic. And even though they may have not met each other in the physical, in the spirit and in their spiritual practices, they felt themselves united as a brotherhood. And with that, he got the indication that he should try and help. By the way, in this pact, that when this bridge was made and they sort of made this pact, the pact was that if any one of those cultures were to fall or were to sort of fall into the hands of, you know, materialism, imperialism, then the other culture would come and either do something to raise that culture back up, you know, breathe life back into it. And if you think now of, has everyone heard of ayahuasca? Yep. Right. If I said that 20 years ago or 10 years ago, maybe one or two, if I said that 30 years ago, hardly anyone, you know. It's a plant that's come from the jungle and it's just become so popular now, and really that plant is holding that pact up, trying to help the European, the white races and the races here in Europe to raise itself back up, you know. The shaman eventually came over to this country and when his first ceremony, the oak spirit of the oak tree came to him and it said, it was you, I've been calling you, and you've responded to my call. And he felt that with the oak tree, that was the oak tree had a spiritual connection with the ayahuasca, because for instance, when you have Ogham alphabet or you do something with the nature elements of this country, the oak tree is kind of like a guru deva, or it's like a king. He's like an elemental king of this land. And so by befriending an oak tree, he's like a spirit that basically guides you to other spirits. And it's the same with the ayahuasca in the jungle. It has a sort of part of its consciousness that is friends with all the other animals, all the other plant allies. So even though you're sort of just drinking this one plant, it is is related to all the other plant spirits as well. And so it sort of grabs your hand, and if you've got a problem in a certain part of your body, it will introduce you to a plant that you should work with to help that part of the body. So the violence of the civil war came to the community and it had to flee, and it rather than going back into the jungle, it came out more into built up areas, into a tourist zone, technically a red zone, but this place is only a red zone because the government are brutalising the people and they don't want the people, they don't want tourists to come.
How does what about all the sort of drugs like cocaine to trade go today? Obviously,
right,
it's really famous, and it's proved, but there's a big,
sure,
how's that kind of working?
In the 70s there was two sides, because gorillas, they were growing their own coca, and it was coca was like a cash crop. Farmers just grew it because it got a good return. And depending on the region where you were, because of the Civil War, it's the case that the government had their drug cartels, had their drug families, and so did the guerrillas. And what you see is the war on drugs. Actually, it's just the war on the competition of the CIA-funded drugs, you know. And basically, they use these chemicals, they spray it on the rainforest, they spray people, and these people come up with all these bumps and all these problems. You know, if they really want the spray a place, they should spray the CIA headquarters in, you know, North America. For some reason, they decide the jungle with all its inhabitants is a better place. And consequences are quite bad, you know, in actual terms of their health and the actual land itself. It kills the fish, it just kills everything, you know. Same thing as, I think it's the same ingredient with Roundup, you know, what that chemical is. It's the stuff that they just sprayed on the jungle to kill the coca. But they weren't destroying the coca, they were just destroying the competition, destroying the funding for the gorillas. So, you know, the civil war there has done a lot to sort of help expand the imperialism, but they've also realised that it's come to a point because of the socialism in Venezuela and in Ecuador, they're trying to basically calm that civil war down in order, and the country's so militarised, they're trying to get Colombia out of the civil war into war with Venezuela, into war with Ecuador. So they basically sprayed all the coca pills. They realise the civil war is inconvenient for the continuation of imperialism, you know. So they've basically, in the 90s they took the gears up and started the whole war on drugs, you know. The last president, Uribe, he was the son, and you maybe you've heard of Pablo Escobar. This guy is one of the famous drug dealer. But he's only the famous drug dealer because he was the enemy for the other drug dealers who were working in compliance with the government. That drug dealer, those drug dealers, their family was Uribe. The last president was President Uribe of Colombia, and 90% of all torture and all human rights abuses in the world happened in Colombia under Uribe, who was democratically elected. Some places, some towns, they were democratically elected by the death squads coming in and marching them to the polls to vote for Uribe. this is the face of, you know, democracy we've got in the world pretty much. And somehow in this environment, in all that hostility, you know, don't worry about the jungle and snakes and jaguars and all this, that's actually living with people, it's interesting enough, you know. But in that environment,
we're trying to make a spiritual base and make, you know, a place that we can call a spiritual home. And all fairness, despite all that violence, despite all that problem, there is a lot more freedom in Latin America to just build, to express yourself, you know, in terms of living on the land than in this country. It's funny how this country is so little.
Everything seems to be brought up in this country. It's really hard to get your own plot of land.
Yeah.
It's all owned up by farmers or barons or
lords, yeah. It's amazing how much land in this country is owned by lords and by estates, you know. It's a phenomenal amount. You know, these swaths of land, is it like 90% of Cornwall or something?
Yeah.
Owned by Prince Charles, you know. Yeah. One person. How many people are there living in council blocks, you know, in Redworth and all these places?
50% of the land in this country is still owned by the 190 families who came over the Normans when they were invading the land years ago.
Is it? Right. Okay. Uh-huh. It looks lovely.
50% or more.
80%.
50.
50%.
Yeah. I had a speech deck right now at 11. It's a speech on access to land.
Is it? Okay, like common land. Okay. Right. I mean, if people are interested in sort of setting up things in this land, you know, it'd be amazing to sort of find one way to basically get in there, but you have to be sort of quite strategic about this, because, you know, if you're sort of trying to establish something on this land, you get one case that does something, move on the common land, set up something. If they make that an example, it'd be quite tricky in terms of, it's either step by step like land matters, but you're playing up their game and they're always just going to shepherd you down, or you just all revolt and go back on the land, and, you know, en masse. Really, if you get something like that happen here, that would be best. But, you know, we're in a very sort of delicate place in this country, politically, socially, you know, with the spy network in, you know, and the paranoia. It's quite intense. Less chance of getting killed and tortured in this country, and yet less people stand up for their rights, you know. In this country, obviously, the land's been taken from people, and of the Celtic traditions say that sovereignty is something which comes from the land. Sovereignty is something which the land itself deems and gives to people. Now, a lot of people talk of Steiner or Rudolf Steiner, and there's a lot of things of Steiner School, which has become popular. And even though Steiner, he wrote and spoke a lot about education, one of his sort of main things he was driving for and spoke to people about is that, it's, you know, to really help human evolution, it's necessary for people to, you know, get a place and call that place a spiritual home. To get people and call that people their spiritual family. He said by like, consecrating your spiritual home and spiritual family, that you will skyrocket your own evolution. You know, and this is something Steiner says, yet Steiner sort of, you know, has been, you know, his agricultural side of things has been sort of manipulated a little bit, you know, sort of away from his teachings. But people, you know, being taken into account, have got the possibility of, you know, starting a spiritual family with a spiritual, you know, spiritual home, land, you know, take the opportunity, even if it's just for, you know, a few months or a few years, okay, it might, you know, you might be cleared off, but just that little time, it'll give you a taste, and you know, it'll be a great, springboard to help you, you know. So, we, you know, we talk about community, and like, you can break this word up into a common unity. It's something that sort of brings us together, you know. Obviously, the land, our food, you know, just the daily work together, and the fact that you don't have supermarkets nearby, you have to, you know, you have to work a lot and work very hard. And, you know, I know in this country there's a lot of information and there's a lot of know-how as to how to do these things, but so far I haven't seen really that many examples of people really growing their own food, people seriously taking that into their own hands. There's actual energy you need to grow your own food and to be self-sustainable. You know, in terms of there being an economic crisis, this is something you have to plan well in advance, you know. It's good on, it's good knowing the theory, but if you're not putting it into practice, then that theory is not, it's worthless, you know. Yeah.
Just a curious question, so I don't really know about it. That's Finhorn.
Okay, this is up in Scotland, you know. I haven't visited it, you know. I've read one of their initiatory books, and it was quite similar, you know. Something that Finhorn had was this spiritual aspect of, you know, this sort of sense of the supreme being or with God, you know, which in this country has become sort of quite, it's become quite tainted to speak of, just use that G word, you know. So, if Freemasonry and all this, you know, it's become sort of quite contrived. But, no, I've read stuff on Findon, I've heard stuff about it, and it sounds very interesting, you know. Just even visiting communities in this country just to get a taste of it, you know. Findon is a very good example of this. So, let's say, you know, I gave the, I said earlier, if you take all of us and we put us in the jungle, we just try and start building a spiritual home. For the first few months, it's going to be interesting, it's going to be exciting, you know, different challenges. After a while, you know, we'll get used to it, you know,
will the things won't start looking new. We'll start seeing this familiarity, you know, in the land where we're walking. We'll start getting like a rhythm with our work. And in the same time, when things start getting familiar, we're going to start having problems with each other. There's going to be personality clashes. You know, there's going to be points of attrition between one another. Now, in the past, these are the things which are usually break up communities, things that sort of wedge things together. And so in the shamanic community, it's necessary to have some kind of principle of one is like working on oneself psychologically. Like one is seeing the negative aspects of oneself and using them for the means of self-change. It's those same problems we have with people. That basically you can then turn them into like into the thing that you bring into meditation. For instance, in meditation, you go, you lie down, nothing happens, you close your eyes, blackness, your thoughts drift, didn't have a good meditation, but then you go off for the rest of the day and you get into problems, you're bumping into people. With those problems, with those conflicts we're getting with people, you know, whatever, we get something, we felt like a jarring with someone. If we take that into our meditation, that what we can extract from the daily situation, you can say that is our daily bread. You know, there's give us today our daily bread. On a spiritual side, our daily bread could be the problems that we have with people, and then when we take that into that our own personal meditation, that those problems, when we digest it, and they do nourish us, you know, and there are things that basically realise, okay, you know, we're not all innocent lambs. There are things inside us which basically cause those problems, and even though we seem like victims when they happen, if we take those problems into our meditation, we see actually there are things in us causing those problems. There are things in us that actually, you know, likes scandal, or, you know, is causing gossip, or has something of ill will. All these negative states in us, something, you know, for instance, the seven deadly sins, it's this inside us, not in the world at large, but what's in us that basically creates these disharmonies, you know. So there's this aspect of like psychological work of working with people, you know. Because there should be one thing quite clear in this planet at the moment, is that humanity has sort of lost its capacity of how to live with each other, you know. And really, if that was just the foundation, you know, it doesn't matter if you've got compost loos using straw or using sawdust, you know, or whether you're, you know, want to build with pine or cypress, you know, these kind of things, those details, that's secondary. You know, the primary thing to get community is that there's harmony between people and there's a sort of sense of unity. And I'd say those sparks and those problems that when we come together and there's these personality clashes, they are kind of like the things, they're like the friction that basically makes that fire that eventually like becomes a source of light, well, a source of heat, and then when you transmutate it and you work through it, it then becomes a source of light. And you can go to someone, you know, you go like have a problem with someone in the community. Let's say a long-standing problem that it takes a long time, you know, a lot of like bad vibes between the people. When you finally break through that,
you just sort it out.
Or no, yeah, when you finally like get through that, you see the part inside yourself that's got the problem. That when you heal that, the amount of strength and the amount of like unity you have with that person, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. It makes them really strengthens relationships and makes them much more practical.
Yeah. Sure.
It's and the people. Stays as well, that effect as well. It doesn't. Die.
Yeah. Sure.
Coming through the challenge really builds both parties.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. This is it. And often it's the time that the people who have the biggest problems with are the people that we can have the strongest alliances with as well. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, once a week we're, not once a week, but on the clock, on the dot, but roughly once a week we have a shamanic practice. Using some plant there from the jungle, sometimes a cactus, sometimes a mushroom or some kind of plant. Now, in terms of, you know, that we're on this land, we're growing all our own food, we're eating this food, and then we're using certain plants that basically awaken our consciousness and put us into a state that forces us to look at our own problems. Now, if you think, you know, on the land or in our own psychology, imagine that we're like wheat. You put the wheat on like a tray, and through all the activity and all the daily commotion that you're banging on this together, and then the wheat and the chaff come together. And if you like that ceremony of using this shamanic plant, or would have been mushroom in this country, or fly garrick, when the communities use a shamanic plant, it's like literally the tray is then being shaped. And all the wheat goes to the bottom, and all the chaff goes to the top. And it's this process of like natural alchemy, of basically just brings up all the stuff to the surface, which then has to be dealt with. But it has to be dealt with each individual according to their inputs, according, you know, whatever part they've put in. There's always this thing of participation, you know. The minute we sort of stop
working on ourselves and stop participating in that process, it's the moment we literally become like a weight, you know, on that community, you know, or on that place. Has anyone got time?
Yeah, it's coming up to 11 o'clock.
Up to 11 o'clock, yeah? Oh, okay. Okay. How many of us are there? 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay. There are, you know, sort of spiritual practices we do in groups. For instance, like mantras, meditation. I think that really helps, like, you know, unify people with things like dances. Like a lot of world dances, Celtic dances, Sufi dances. Anything which sort of does stuff that sort of moves people together and gets them to work together in harmony. And creating these things, it sort of brings, it calls in another energy, and it sort of weaves something, you know, between the people that really, you know, is like the Celtic knotwork. You know, it sort of weaves something that everyone has their points, everyone has their line, but it all works together and it all, you know, comes together beautifully. But after a few years and after a few decades of like community, you still start, you know, writing a lot of songs, you know, a lot of inspiration comes through. A lot of inspiration comes through with the medicine as well. And in those songs, and really in the community, there's very few other songs we play but our own songs, because there's so quite a lot of people, you know, throughout the various farms. So when you're playing your own music, playing your own songs, making your own dances, that in that energy, it sort of brings in like a new energy. That you're not sort of relying on, you know, the stereo, you're not relying on, you know, the internet to give your entertainment. It's like you are making your music, you are making your dances. And it creates something, it sort of creates like a force field around that, you know, around that space that basically sort of gives it like a magical protection, and it sort of, you know, it creates this unity. And you cannot put this into words. It's something that you experience for yourself, and it's, you know, it's beyond anything you could read, you know. One thing the Indians say is that the Indians, they know Yehe. The Indians, they know Paiute. But the European knows books, you know. But, you know, you still can read, you can still like study stuff, it helps. But actually, in terms of going to the plants, you can learn so much more, you know, stuff that you would never be able to read up about stuff in books either, you know. And in group discussions, group things. In the community, we have a principle of, let's say, red tents. They call it in North America. Randito, they call it in Colombia, or our community. It's connected to the women's noontime. In that menstruation cycle, the women wouldn't go into like heavy work, wouldn't do things that wouldn't eat certain foods, but they'd go to an area where it's like they would rest, and food would get brought to them. And say in that moment of the women's menstruation, there are certain kind of like lunar forces that come in that basically wake up sort of a lot of like lower passions in the men. So if you have and to a lot of people it sounds atrocious, like you take the women and you put them apart. But when you're living in that environment, it's the men are jealous of the women because they have the time off to basically recuperate, to make all this lovely jewellery, to, you know, practice all these instruments. And actually for the women, you know, it's an amazing help. And you see there in the men that when there's that separation between on a woman on her moon cycle, and then, you know, they're not actually together, they're not sharing the same bed, they're not sharing the same kitchen, there's less arguments, you know, there's less problems with between the men and the women. That it sort of creates this magnetism, that when you sort of move them away in that point, it's either separate beds or something, it basically, yeah, it sort of charges that magnetism up. That sort of keeps the relationship still, you know, sort of gives it force and keeps it healthy. And we apply that principle in the community as well with the red tent. There's a lot of mysteries around that as well. Think about in this world, you know, like a woman, she grows up and she doesn't get told this, and then one day she's at school and suddenly she just starts bleeding from down, you know, from the orifice. For her, it's horrific, you know, no one explains it to her. They take her away, you know, and for her, it's like they don't know what to do with it. And for a lot of women, it's a traumatic experience, so they don't know what's going on, they're scared, you know. And think about when you're children, you want to grow into the world, you know, you want to do what the adults are doing. You sort of want to flourish and become a part of that. But for a lot of women, without that red tent, rather than flourishing into the world, suddenly they're taken away and they're put into this space. And for them, you know, in the society, it's something which sort of creates quite a damage on the women, that taking away that mystery from them, you know. If you have a space in a community or a place where that's literally been made into a mystery, that when a woman comes on that cycle, they then grow into the Red Tent. And you see the women there much stronger and, you know, much healthier because of that. That's the sort of principle of Red Tent. It does something to basically empowers women even more. But I explain it in this country to a lot of people, and it seems like it seems cruelty that we're just like taking all the women away because they're dirty and they have to be over there. But the case is quite opposite, you know. It's really, it really gives women a lot of power to have the Red Tent. So, are there any questions at this point? Yeah, good question. There's two questions there. Why are they buying it? Why are they selling it? You know, because both are ridiculous. But, I mean, the Chinese, they're buying the rivers in Colombia because Colombia's got more accessible, clean water. It's on the equator, it's in the mountains, so it gets a lot of water through a lot of mountains. And so basically when you dam all these rivers and these mountains up, you suddenly have a hell of a lot of water. And if, in terms of, like, resources for the future, China have done their homework quite well and basically bought these rivers. If there's going to be water crises in the future, Chinese companies and the Colombian water is going to be a very sort of significant factor. Sadly, we've got our farms in that region.
That's outrageous,
yeah, you know. It's beyond logical thinking. You've got to think these people are, you know, mentally sick to think, you know. It defies logic. There's 33 dams going to be built. If anyone knows that number, it's quite significant. Sister, about now.
I might have missed it because I wasn't here at the beginning, but are you doing lots of work with the tribes around you, or people around you, to try and teach them?
Right. Most of the campesinos, they don't need teaching. You know, most actual farmers, they
all
just... What can you do? These guys are poor, they have money to the bank, you know. We do things to go out there and make some sort of like social ripple. So someone who goes around, he doesn't do this as a job, but basically in the last 2 years, he's been making this mission of going to different communities, farming communities, and giving them conferences about genetic modification, about Monsanto, about, you know, but these people, they're in a losing battle. They earn the money to the banks. At the end of the day, if he comes public, he will just get a bullet sent in the post, or he will just get killed. You know, and this, you have to be very delicate when explaining these things to the people, you know. If union leaders come up, and people, yeah, they want protests to go on protest, but if a union leader comes up, his name just gets put on a list for a death squad. So in terms of what we can actually do to really help the Indians don't need help, you know, you go there, you know, you sort of, and some Indians people go there, it's like, how do we help the Indians? The Indians are like, oh, the Westerners want to come and they want to help us, you know, it's like, well, stop coming, just leave us alone, you know.
But I do feel we've given them an idea just about money and materialism and all those things, whereas if you, I know, it's not about teaching them anything, but if you influence them differently and show them how to work their land sustainably, or so they didn't need to rely on money and so they then weren't poor, mm-hmm. or how to use their land to make profit in a different way. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing. You know, I've thought about it a lot, and that's the sort of thing I imagine being impossible.
Yeah. I would definitely say, and what has been said by people, you know, in the community, and people have sort of mystical vision, is that if there's ever a mission to do to try and help people, it's to teach them about genetic modification. It's stuff like this, it's this sort of information which here we know quite well, and which the farmers there, they don't know. In terms of farming sustainably, farming organically, if we just left them to it, they would do a fantastic job, you know. But in terms of, it's, you know, they need to be educated about genetic modification, you know.
So there isn't some local microfinancing available to actually remove the power from the big banks and the big multinationals?
No, not really. You know, it's the kind of country that basically can't do that. You know, it's because of the death squads. You know, anything that is a threat to business, you'll get a bullet sent in the post. You know, or you will just get killed. You know, you have to be very strategic in this country as to, you know, how to help people.
Yeah. How many people are living on you?
Say it again?
How many people are living where you
live? There's a few farms, and in one farm there's about 50, in quite a big area of land, you know, maybe sort of the whole of this festival site plus the race course, you know. And in the other land, it's probably maybe about a third of the size, it's about 20 to 30 there. And they've just bought land in the jungle as well, in Ecuador. And so, you know, it's a lot of people. One principle of in the shamanic community, obviously you have this thing of shaman. There's one person there who's visionary and has, if you like, a certain power, like bestowed upon him from the nature. And a lot of traditions, it's something which is like not necessarily inherited, but it's like a lineage that gets passed on. like a magical power. If you think in terms of spiritual brotherhood, then it's like the older brother or the wisest then inherits that title. And to a lot of people in this country, we sort of see it backwards. We sort of see it like this guy is ordering us. But actually, it's the case. It's more, he lets us do whatever we want to do, you know. And if there's, we know the rules, we know the arena, and at whatever moments we're going to do things which are either going to create harm to ourselves, to other people, or create things that will cause problems in the society, you can literally stop an action like a minute before we step into a pile of crap, you know. He has a sort of uncanny ability to know someone's going to make a mistake, and then just at that moment where he's going to make the mistake, he stops it, calls everyone's attention, and, you know, and makes an example of that person. Obviously it's a bit humiliating when you're the person, you know, in the hot seat. Actually, for the whole community, it really helps to have this sort of, if you like a spiritual shepherd, one who just lets people do their thing, and when something's about to fall, he then basically comes in and, you know, has the ability to turn things around. Not necessarily always him, there are other people who also are able to see that, but if everyone else is asleep in the consciousness, he's been given the sort of power to basically come in and sort of stop those big problems. So it's not, even though you can say he's a spiritual leader, a spiritual guide, he's not telling us what to do, he's not guiding us. He's more of the capacity of shepherd, and he's hoping that we will, you know, are rising up to our own ability, you know. We each have to work on ourselves, you know. But there's a heritage there of, obviously, of him, yeah, he is a leader, he is a spiritual leader. And it's sort of, in that sense, it resonates very much with the sort of idea of king and queen, and this and the ancient Celtic societies of, you know, one has been given like a sovereignty, given a power of nature, and that power of nature, you know, enables them to see like the problems of that community, the things that are going to attack, and how to orchestrate things in order for, yeah, it's magical, you know, to have someone up there pulling the things. Is something which something you can only, yeah.
In terms of, as you were saying earlier, building a group of people in a project that aims towards what you believe is the real goal of life, what you're pointing to build consciousness. The project you just described is absolutely satisfying. To have this ritual each week that's shamanic, mm-hmm. you know, people bring up the stuff,
yeah.
to grow your food and to work hard on that, mm-hmm. to separate the men at the moment in the installation. All yeah. this is what satisfaction to you, like,
it's project work. No, I wouldn't say that satisfaction, you know, it's really, really hard work, you know, it's the kind of hard work that is, you know, it makes you stronger, you know, it gives like a robust character, you know. Generally, sort of people who grow near nature, they go through very sort of hard type experiences, it gives them a strong character, you know, and there's something which sort of weakens their ego. And, in this society, we have everything so easily and so cushy materially that the ego is super strong and our characters are very weak. You know, which sort of is like a disability, you know. I can't say in that sense, you know, to see, because these things that force you to look at your own problems, I can't really say I'm satisfied, you know, seeing all my problems, seeing my envy, seeing my, you know, hatreds, you know. That in itself is not necessarily satisfying. But to see that and then, even though to feel all those problems, and it's, you know, there's a lot of negativity that goes to the side, but then when you realise that everyone's going through that, we're all carrying this, you know, we're all suffering from the same thing, you know, at heart. And when you're living in a community and you realise that you're all suffering and you're all working it together, it's like mercy, you know, to know that everyone's going through the same thing, but, you know, we're all going through it together, you know. So, you know, it's merciful. I wouldn't say satisfactory.
We hope so. Can you reword the question? Yeah.
You were saying earlier, you were talking about what you thought was the most purposeful thing to do in this life, which is to prepare to the transition to death.
Oh, I see.
What you would put your energy in.
Okay. So, you know, obviously you want to put our energy into life, you know, and put our energy into things that sort of sustain life. And in terms of in this country, in this culture, it's very hard to live in a way where we're not contributing to the culture of death. You know, contributing to something which is, you know, sort of polluting something, you know. I don't want to get people paranoid and caught up in this dogma of, you know, must recycle everything or must do, you know, this kind of thing. But, you know, I personally feel the thing which is sort of even more destructive and the thing which sort of causes more the more death and the more destruction more than anything is the way we literally tell it. And sort of, you know, the problems of the discord that we have and the ill will we have between people. You know, that is the real poison. That basically, without that poison, you know, the other contaminations would probably sort themselves out, you know, into biology. You know. And it's good to do things to sort out the bigger contaminations, but it's that thing which poisons our hearts. You know, clearing that is the thing which is going to, bring us up, take us beyond, you know, this mortal coil. You know, it's a love for something which is beyond this material realm. You know, because if you only love the things in this material realm, you know, you'll be bound to it. But if we're working with a group of people and there's these other psychological states, these other magical moments, these other sort of shared sentiments and feelings, it's these things which are sort of beyond the material, and we start feeling a love in that group consciousness, and we feel that there's in there, it's that love which is building a bridge, you know, beyond life, you know. It's that sort of love for things like beyond this sort of physical matter, you know. I'll just finish off with
So that was Tamach at the Green Gathering talking about all manner of aspects of community, and I was particularly struck by actually the similarities between what's going on in Colombia and what's going on here. It's just that over there you've got death squads and illicit armies and all that kind of stuff, and people are actually being killed. I suppose a degree of that happens over here, but over here it's much more subtle. Over here it seems to me that we're suffering a kind of slow administrative strangulation, or anybody who tries to do anything independent or different from the norm, and this happens for all sorts of reasons. I mean, his speaking about community in the apparent United Kingdom, I'd come across examples myself, really, of all the things that he's talking about. The institutionalised community, where people have got together in a kind of flush of enthusiasm, and this often works really well. People have got maybe a degree of resource that they've brought with them as a result of, I don't know, selling one thing or moving out, or just sort of getting it together for this moment when a bunch of people are going to finally find a way of maybe trying to do their own thing with their own lives, and the spirit of the moment and all of the resource and whatever else comes along really can carry it for sort of 2-3, maybe more years, in fact, as stuff gets built up and dreams are realised. But things do become institutionalised. Slowly but surely things get set into some kind of human version of concrete. People take on roles. It seems to be that it's, by, I don't know, perhaps part of the way we're conditioned, and I think we all acknowledge that we're being pretty heavily conditioned one way or the other, first by the family, then by whatever it is we get that passes for education, by not just the television and the newspapers, but by whatever entertainment it is that we choose to read and take on board. Communities very easily take on sets of rules to try and maintain the institution that's been set up, or to try to, quite often, I think, to try and stop things falling apart. There's maybe a bit of a meeting. There's been some sort of difficulty, a lot of it interpersonal, as Tamach gets into later on. And in order to try and prevent these personal difficulties from, I don't know, causing collapse or breakdown, then rules are set up as a kind of compromise to enable people to continue to live together without actually sorting out or addressing the interpersonal stuff that's arising. And over time, a lot of this can occur, you know, maybe 8 or 10 years into a community actually arising. A lot of these different personal difficulties arise, and so a lot of different sets of rules are set up to try and ameliorate the effects of them. It's one of the things that I definitely look for when I'm going to communities, is not too many rules, and certainly I prefer to live in an environment which doesn't have lots of bits of paper stuck up over the place telling you what you can and what you can't do. Really, it's important, rather like we've realised about the world that we're living in, that all of the laws, all the many tens of thousands of so-called laws, legislative acts and instruments and all the rest that are being formed, there's no possible way we could or would even want to understand all of that stuff, and none of it has got anything to do with us. All we want to do is live our lives with our families or our friends or whatever, and, you know, as long as we're not treading on anybody else's toes, then that really ought to be good enough. And it's the same writ small in a community. Large numbers of rules, or indeed really any rules, even if there's only a few of them, ideally, I think, should be unnecessary, because by and large, when people are working together, when they've got open hearts and when they're trying to address the difficulties that arise, rather than work their way around them, then some kind of progress is more likely to be made. It's very, very common to come across what to match called the trustees and serfs setup, where somebody actually owns the land, other people, well, you know, nominally owns the land. Of course, nobody owns the land. I know that he said that we're in fact leasing it from the Crown, which I suppose is technically correct, but I mean, how can her upstairs actually own the land either? I mean, I know she thinks she does, and probably a lot of other people do as well, but actually, like they say, there's no pockets in a shroud. But many times I've come across, it's very difficult, see, it seems to be very difficult anyway, if you actually own land, to genuinely enable people to come on it and manifest their full potential without you kind of interfering for one reason or another. And the trustees and serfs thing is a very common setup, even though that's often the way communities don't start. Sometimes they can start in quite an egalitarian way with everybody pretty much equal, but one way or the other, there does seem, just like there seems to be a kind of natural dynamic to develop institutions and rules, there also seems to be a kind of dynamic which eventually leads to kind of wealthier people somehow having to do less of the work, and the poorer people who've generally got more children and the rest having to do more of the work. Again, it seems to be a pretty natural movement, or maybe it's not a natural movement, maybe it's just that it happens a lot, maybe once again it's part of the conditioning, maybe it's just because people don't want to face what it is that needs to be faced when you're living with other people to try and reach for the breakthrough. There's too much work goes into avoiding the breakdown, not enough work that goes into to trying to achieve the breakthrough. And as far as the illusion of owning land, you know, if you do, it doesn't really matter whether you've actually got the title deeds, whether you've actually been in the wider community for 20 years or so. If what you are doing does not match what the Crown or its local agents want, and they notice that, then sooner or later they're going to come along and they're going to start sticking their spoon in the pudding and trying to interfere with what's going on. The permaculture project that he talked about did work to a certain extent. They found ways of setting up a means where several people could live to a certain extent and work on the land towards something that was acceptable in kind of local planning terms, and that kind of worked out in as far as the people involved in the project got what they wanted, which is somewhere to live, a community of people to live with, and they also got to do what they really wanted to do with the land, which was start using it more naturally, start growing their own crops, because as one of the ladies in the audience says, and to match himself pointed out, just because something says organic on it doesn't mean to say it's good for you. In fact, it's probably a long way from meaning it's anything like organic. Very, very difficult, of course, given what's happening to the water and what's happening to the air, to make sure that even the stuff we do ourselves is actually organic in any proper sense of the word. But still, if you want the best veg or the best meat or whatever it is, then the only way you can be sure that you're not just receiving a bit of hearsay and a bit of advertising and a bit of bunkum is to either be doing it yourself or to know the people who are doing it and where they're doing it. And so the permaculture project, I think he called it Landmass, was reasonably successful. And yes, it's a kind of way that has enabled people to get a community together. Other ways are to build the community secretly and try and hide it away. That was reasonably successful. I guess that probably Google Earth's making it a little bit more difficult to do that. And even then, eventually somebody's going to spot something as happened out at Lammas, where a solar panel was spotted by a passing helicopter or something, and somebody put in a report or a complaint, and as a result, planners visited. And I think in the long run, the compromise there was that they had to pay all of the money that they would have had to pay to get planning permission, had they got it in the first place. Otherwise, the buildings, would, you know, their little hobbit houses and stuff were going to be removed. So again, they managed to effectively, one way or the other, to kind of dodge and weave a little bit around the legislation, and they managed to get pretty much what they wanted. Although, once again, I think there's quite a lot of money involved in that particular setup now. But as Tamash said, what happens there is, as soon as you kind of, like the permaculture project or the place where you kind of end up having to do the retrospective planning permission, you end up living with the council. Once you've signed any bit of paperwork, once these people have shown any interest at all in what it is you're doing with your land, whether you own it or not, or whether you've just come by it, you end up living with the council and with all of their rules. And your biggest worry gets to be not, where's my warmth coming from? Where's my food coming from? Well, you know, where are my friends going to be? Your biggest worry comes to be, what are the neighbours going to think? And that's another piece of experience that I think it's worth talking about a little bit, is that really you can live in a place unnoticed, like those guys in Southwest Wales, for a long, long time. And everything's completely hunky-dory. Nobody comes looking. Nobody causes any trouble. You're doing exactly what you like to do. But as soon as anybody makes a complaint, then there are whole departments and organisations of the kind of local representatives of the Crown or the Corporation or whatever we want to call these people, the World Management Team. And it's not like it's going to fall apart just a little bit at a time. It's like as soon as that happens, the entire infrastructure comes in looking at your health and safety, and basically using it as an excuse for coming and taking a spanner to the life you've set up for yourself. So you can never really be secure in the knowledge that what you've set up is going to continue, because it can so easily be undone about you. And it might be somebody complaining about, the fact that there's horse shit or cow shit around the place, and that it's got E. coli in it. That is good enough for people to start launching 20, 30, 40 page documents at you about the danger of E. coli and the fact that you can get it on this and you can get it on that and you can get it on the other. These people are not going to come to you and say, there's E. coli about the place, but you've got loads and loads of that in you and all you need is a strong immune system and you'll be absolutely fine. What they're going to do is absolutely use these previously unperceived so-called dangers to just make it very, very difficult for you to do what you want to do. And that happens even if you are under the illusion that you have title to the piece of land that you're on. I mean, as far as I can tell, Guy Taylor has got pretty much indisputable title to the piece of land that he's been fighting over for so long, and it's not stopping people spending an enormous amount of money and putting an enormous amount of uniforms over his gates and giving him a huge amount of grief. Now, there really shouldn't be any question about what's going on there or who it is that's in the wrong. But one way or the other, when they want to have a go, they have a go. And this is one of the most difficult things, I think, about setting up community. And I also think that, it's a sign that community is a good thing to go for, the fact that there's so many different ways of preventing it from happening. I think that Tamash's point that in normal everyday life, those of us, I think we were all like it once, who are turning our eyes away from our real responsibilities for the planet or for the big blue ball on which we live, and for the people around us, our responsibilities for the safety and happiness of others as well as the safety and happiness of ourselves, has been reduced to ticking boxes, what we choose to do. I mean, you know, at the so-called green end of the spectrum, we buy organic, because we might believe that the organic is actually organic and it's not coming from anywhere that's even slightly dodgy, although when we look into it, we might well discover that it's a truly, truly undermined principle as far as the commercial world goes. We might go for recycling, which a bit like the organic is maybe, hey, maybe not all it appears to be. We might buy low energy light bulbs, even though they're completely lethal or potentially lethal chem hazard when you break them, and they're emitting frequencies that really aren't so good as you as the old high power full daylight bulbs would have been. We might go for fair trade. All of this is the kind of green end of it. I don't know, at the other end of it, you might be going out to build nuclear power stations and kind of go out with guns and stuff. But everybody's got their own way of feeling like they're taking responsibility for, I don't know, society as they see it, whatever it is we want to call it. But really, it's just a kind of plastic responsibility. It's not until we actually step into our own responsibility and start becoming responsible for our own actions and our own effect on the places and people that we reside that we're really taking fair cop. Ticking boxes just ain't good enough. And I guess Tomas was talking about community as a way of seriously taking on that kind of responsibility. He was suggesting that we're, by living together, by endeavouring to live together and stay living together and sort out the problems that that throws up, that we are actually making consciousness that we only get to understand about ourselves by looking at ourselves the way we're reflected in other people. We can talk to ourselves as much as we like, but it's only by talking to other people and by seeing what we think reflected in their knowledge that we're going to come to any kind of consciousness ourselves. And he was suggesting that the capacity to live together, the capacity even to live together and to care, is one way, or possibly the way, of making consciousness, of actually taking responsibility for what's going on rather than for evading it. You know, over in Colombia, he was talking about rich oligarchs owning private armies. Well, we know we've got private armies now in this country. The police might as well be a private army. The London Transport Police, more and more of them are carrying guns. More and more of them are behaving like really, really threatening individuals. Over there, you know, they use the proper shiny army with all the legal guns and stuff if they want to do something that that needs to be done and the world might approve of. And they use death squads if they want to move peasants off the land. And all of this is disguised as a civil war. Tomas pointed out that that's exactly what the civil war was in this country. It was a way of moving the peasants off the land so that the aristocrats could grab more of it. And as one of the listeners in the audience, it's a bit difficult to make him out, pointed out, the people who came over here kind of 1000 AD and stole the land, mostly it is their descendants who still have it. And I'd suggest that majority of the other people who still got land in this country probably got it in the 1600s, by whatever means. But really, they don't need death squads in this country. We're an unarmed population. We seem to be pretty supine. Most of all, if a bailiff is seen going for somebody, then it really is amazing to watch your friends just kind of back off and think instantly that because the bailiffs or the police around, that you must have done something to deserve it. And this is a failure of care. It's a failure of care for our friends and our neighbours. And it's true to a certain extent in Wales. It's definitely true in England. I know there's places in Scotland where when a bailiff turns up on the street, everybody's going to turn out and they're going to make sure he goes away or takes a kicking. And maybe that kind of approach is something that we need to be thinking about. But we don't need the death squads and the civil war and anything here. We are a supine population as far as I can see. And here, a complaint is all that's needed to bring down the full force of the administration to just come and make life very, very difficult. Even if the complaint is invalid or just about something that's not like about something where you're killing somebody or making them ill or causing them damage or robbing them. It can be a complaint about making too much noise. It can just be anything. It can be almost anything. And if we take the strategic approach to land, such as was used by the permaculture project, even if you don't feel that you're living with the council, which effectively you do end up doing, and I'm pretty sure the councils, one way or another, they might as well be regarded as criminal entities, and one way or the other you're playing their game. Somehow we're no longer playing our own game as soon as that occurs. And all of this gives us real difficulty forming any sort of genuine community in the long term. I think it's possibly one of the reasons why I personally enjoy the small festivals so much, is because there at least you get to experience this kind of open-hearted, productive relationship with people, and to see your own reflection, to actually rise to any difficulties that come up, as they do. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff being done. And you might not be able to live in it, you know, but at least you can experience it for, you know, 5, 6, 7 days for one festival. I guess that given the way, a proper way of moving around the place, which is, of course, itself a fairly major problem, you could live doing that for several months of the year, 3, 4, maybe 5 months of the year. You could wander around helping to build this festival, then that one. There are enough of them scattered across the year for you to possibly not need to go anywhere else during the 5 months, and that might be a good way of doing it. But one way or the other, I really think that this need to manifest consciousness in the form of proper human relationship, caring relationship, where people are there to help other people, not only through the easy times but through the bad times as well, and where our own reflection on other people is there to take us forward, to make us wiser, to teach us more things than we learn when we're just living behind our own front doors. And as I've said, even if you nominally own the land that you're happy to crouch on at whatever time, what happens in it is definitely not necessarily in your power. It's just in the fact that nobody's complained about what you're doing, it seems to me. And it's not really just personal evolution that occurs as a result of having access to land and security. I think it's the possibility for generating wealth, and by that I don't mean illusory money. By wealth I mean the possibility to build skills and the things that you make with your skills, which in their turn attract people with different skills that you can add to. A wealth in people and a wealth in unique things that you can build yourself, grow yourself. Manifestation, wealth in terms of the manifestation of your ideas. If you can't stay in a community that's going to support you and help you out, then it's very, very difficult to see what we would manifest as a result of having whatever it is, 60, 70, 80 years on this planet. I mean, how many of us have got anything other than tat that we've bought to show for the fact that we're here? And yet many of us are geniuses, many of us are good with our hands, many of us are artists, many of us are poets or songsters, many of us can build furniture, sheds, composting toilets, whatever. There's loads and loads of things we can do, and really we should be able to, or even our families over time, should be able to manifest this beauty and this reality into our world, rather than simply working to pay for tax and pay for war and to keep the man off our back. And as Tomáš said, the problems that arise, eventually he said that once the community's been there for a while, once it's settled itself in, once the land has become familiarity and the adventures, the original adventures kind of moving out of it, then we start getting problems arising with people, with the people that we're living with. And these are as much as anything problems arising with the self. We've heard many times on the show that what we see outside ourselves can only be a reflection of our own mental furniture, because we've only got our own experience to judge it by. So to a certain extent, things that appear to be causing us trouble as a result of the activities of other people are actually, when we look carefully or even think about it a little bit, problems that are arising within ourselves. The kind of emotional rush we get when we feel anger or jealousy or what are labelled as negative emotions are quite often arising. The only reason we're feeling excited is because we have a personal interest. And I thought Tomáš's suggestion that we actually stand back a little bit and actually meditate on this kind of thing so that we can see what's going on from the other person's point of view, or see ourselves reflected in them, however it is we want to phrase it. Now, I gather from talking to lots of people, ayahuasca isn't something that I've personally tried, but I know a lot of people who have now. I remember when we'll be hearing from Fred Gillam next week talking about medicinal mushrooms and plant spirit medicine, and he was saying that he thinks that the arrival of ayahuasca in this country is maybe not to our advantage. Now, I'm not sure whether he's talking generally or whether he's talking about the fact that a lot of the people who are claiming to be ayahuascaras, i.e. kind of people who really know how to use this stuff, are possibly not that. And that maybe a proper ayahuascaro, as kind of encountered in somewhere like Colombia or Brazil or wherever, might be a much more useful experience. But I have heard what seem to be reliable reports that this plant medicine can make people better. It apparently has a pretty good ground record on curing people of hard physical addictions to things like heroin. Who knows? But what Tomáš was saying is that that it does give inspiration, and that it does give paths to resolution of difficulties. Maybe we need to do that. Maybe we need to think about our own entheogens, the magic mushrooms and the rest of the stuff that grows out in the countryside. But much more simply, maybe we just need to think a little bit more about what we're doing. Go inside, think about how we're reacting to something. Because if we genuinely weren't interested in the difficulties that are arising with other people, then we wouldn't. Our pulse would not be quickening. We would not feel ourselves heated up and wanting to shout. And as I personally discovered, actually dealing, resolving problems that arise with other people rather than turning to getting angry about them, shouting about it, ruining the relationship, walking away, whatever, there's many different ways of dealing with it. When the resolution actually occurs, then any relationship that lived through that become much, much stronger, more reliable relationships. And also I think it's true to say that you don't get such difficulties again. It's almost like it's a kind of some kind of rite of passage, a sort of baptism, if you like. And when you've got a lot of people living together or working together, there's a chance for a lot of that sort of stuff to go on. So there's a chance for a lot of resolution. There's a chance for a lot of strengthening of relationship. And maybe it might be that pairs, couples of people, sets of three people might go through these kind of things. And so you might get stronger teams of people working as a result. And it does seem to me that if that's the case, then it's extremely well in the interests of the world management team to keep us each with our own front door and to prevent us from discovering this kind of stuff. Because on our own, we're pretty helpless. But together, I suspect we'd probably be more or less unstoppable. I certainly think from listening to what Linda and Guy were saying when she was on the UK column earlier on today, that she and Guy are deeply grateful for all of the help they've been getting. And we all know, I think, who've been involved in these various incidents with men in fancy dress and people who believe themselves to have some kind of authority over other individuals, that a number of people being present makes all the difference. It makes it very, very difficult to take the kind of action that is taken is now being taken against lots of lone, powerless people who don't even begin to suspect that there's anything they can do about it and have no kind of support at all. And wouldn't it be great if, when this kind of shit's going down, if people felt an automatic a tendency, a desire to actually go to help rather than turn your back and shut your door or shut the curtains or whatever. If there was if there was a kind of upwelling down the street of people going, we can't have that, we better go down there because, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, that could easily be me. It would be even better if, without even having to think, that could easily be me, we could just think, right, I'm going to go and help. And I really think that if we were getting practice in community, if we were getting practice in resolving difficulties with each other, if we were getting to see bigger varieties of people in our daily life, then we would be more likely to be responding like that. I can't help feeling that sitting behind our own front doors and I don't know, it doesn't have to be watching the telly or listening to the news. We all pick our own kind of entertainment, and all of it has a tendency to separate us from doing the work of real relationship. I think this is such an important thing. I guess the more I think about community, the more I explore it, the more I realise why it is that I'm doing it. It's kind of like just the search itself is making me realise so much more about what it is that I'm looking for. I love Tomash's point as well about how, over in Brazil and Colombia and the rest, they've got ayahuasca and various other things as well. Peyote, I think you mentioned, but there's quite a lot of different things over there. And now we've got books. Well, very good, isn't it? How much stuff are we going to be learning from books compared with, say, from our native sacred mushrooms or whatever? Also thought it was quite interesting what he was saying about the separation of the women during their moon period. That I know that there's been quite a lot of research to suggest that women who are living in close community, that their cycles quite often, synchronize, begin to coincide with each other. I know that a lot of studies were done with people living in student flats and all that kind of sets of student flats, and it was found that the women tended to coincide, which would mean that when these ladies are moved to one side because it's their time of the month, as it were, and Tomash was saying that the reason that was done was because it started agitating lower instincts in the men, which I suppose is as good a reason as any for moving the women to one place. But it would mean that maybe not all of them, but maybe a lot of them were being moved to this special place all at the same time. And he was saying they were getting the chance to create jewellery, learn to play musical instruments and all that kind of stuff, all of which would be really great. I mean, I think it'd be really fine for the women to get a little bit of time off every month. And my own feeling is, because I have a bit of a cynical attitude to these things, as many of you will know, my own feeling is that it would probably give the men a bit of a break as well. And as Tomash said, it does recharge the relationship, and it does give everyone gives everyone a rest. And what about the idea of doing the hard work? And it really is hard work, this farming lark. I've been doing a lot more of it recently. They're not long days, not compared with the kind of days I used to work when I was working in industry, when sometimes I was in there for 12, maybe 16 hours a day. These relatively short days, they kind of kick off, I guess, about 8 o'clock in the morning, and the actual kind of work's done by about 4:30 or so. But there's still a lot of people work to be done. As much as you're awake when you're living in community and doing this kind of stuff, there's people stuff to be done all the time. And it's tiring. It is. It is hard work. It's hard work in many, many different ways that you can't even begin to think until you actually try doing it. It's doing hard work and it's being near nature, those two things. I've spent today planting a new rose garden. We sorted all the roses out. The rose garden itself was really a patch of rubble up until a few weeks back, but now it's got all the manure that was actually made by the cows on the farm and all that kind of stuff. And there were three of us in there digging holes and putting these roses in. There's a fantastic sense of satisfaction. But one of the things I enjoyed most about it is there is a baby blackbird who just doesn't give a toss about human beings. It doesn't have any sense of danger at all. I don't think it's even learnt how to squawk properly yet. It sounds like it's sneezing when it makes a noise. But it's hopping around, grabbing worms straight from by your feet and things like that. I think it probably helps that there's a no-cat rule here. Any blackbird that tried that in most towns would have been eaten within days of getting out of its shell. It wouldn't be as big and bright-eyed as this little critter is. And we're seeing toads and lizards. I mean, as I was sitting here getting ready to do the show, just a tiny little shrew ran across my feet, just by the end of my toe. Fantastic little creature, all bright-eyed, scuttling about the place. They really like being close to nature. And yet, if the powers that be, or the world management team, whatever we want to call them, had their way, then all buildings would be sealed from having mice or shrews or birds or anything in them, because it's not healthy. They've all got E. coli, you know. They've all got it. Can't trust any of them. Anyway, Tomash said this hard work and being near nature led to what he called having a strong character and a weak ego, which means you're less willing to fight for meaningless things, and I think you know more about what you want. And he was suggesting what he said is an easy life in the West leads to strong ego and weak character. I don't think we're having an easy life here anymore. I think anybody that tells you that we are having an easy life is pulling your plonker, frankly. But wouldn't we really be rather putting our energy into our lives and our relationships and into sustaining our lives and relationships instead of putting it into activities that simply pay tax, kill the earth on which we rely for our life, and experiencing so much ill will? I'm sure we would. That was a bit of a rant, wasn't it? Look, I'm going to put some music on now. I have actually got a sort of 25-minute interview that I did with Tamach just as we were taking everything apart at the Green Gathering, because I really enjoyed his talk, and there were two or three things that I wanted him to expand on a bit. So I'm going to put on a couple of tunes, and then we'll listen to that interview, which is there was a lot less background noise because everything was being took apart. You can hear the background noise of things being took apart instead. Great little tune that, eh? That's Don't Do ID from Standing Strong by Seize the Day, and thanks to Seize the Day for giving me that CD, because I was completely out of cash by the time I got to see them. We have been playing the odd Seize the Day song over the times. There's a few good numbers on that. We'll be hearing another one from them before the end of the show. And before that, Tracy Curtis. Basically, the reason why I didn't have any money left to buy a Seize the Day CD was because I spent the last of my cash getting both of hers. As I say, it's not very often you get to see a solo lady with an acoustic guitar headlining a set, but she has done a lot of really enchanting, well, they're not enchanting songs, actually. She's got, I think, a really lovely voice, and she writes a well punchy lyric, so we'll be hearing a fair bit more from her over the weeks, I hope. So back to a bit more of the talky stuff before I went off on a bit of a rant. I was meaning to play a little chat I had with Tamach before we parted company. I really enjoyed meeting this chap. Apparently I missed, because I'm over here in the West, I missed a chance to meet him in the woods recently. But I hope he had a good time there. I hope he's listening. Be nice if you were, Tamach. But here we go. It's about 25 minutes of a chat in which I tried to draw him out a little bit on some of the more interesting points in his talk, living in shamanic community, not on it. And we kind of swing in halfway through the conversation. One of the things that has been rather fascinating me about festival crews, truthers generally, a lot of the people I know who are into the trust law, well, just people generally, there do seem to be a lot of us non-compliant individuals who like to smoke a little bit of tobacco. I think there's far more of us proportionally that do than that don't, and I think that's a bit interesting. And that's really kind of burst in on a conversation that I was having with Tamach about that. Back with you in about 25 minutes. Tar for being there, folks, and tar for being all the enthusiasm in the chat box. I really appreciate it. It's great to know you're out there.
It's amazing how many of us are smokers, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's refreshing to come here and not see so many of those electric cigarette
things. I hate those. I really don't trust them at all.
It seems like one of those great ideas that's just going to become, you know, another chain.
Yes.
Tetris technology, yeah. You know.
Well, you can sort of already see it, can't you? The kind of the grocery of the marketing and all of that, and the variety of different ones. And
aye.
I want my cigarettes to taste of tobacco. I don't want them to taste of strawberry and vanilla.
Sure, yeah. It's more the spirit behind the plant. You know, yeah. It's interesting, wasn't it? Because in shamanism, they use the tobacco. If you have a lot of tobacco smoke, it stops like spirits going into your aura. So people sort of heavy smokers, you know, like a sort of chain smokers, they kind of probably attached to that. But if you take away and make it electronic, obviously you take away that level of protection, you know?
Yes. I wonder if that's why, because I'm constantly struck by how many of, you know, the various truthers and the Open Heart Brigade, and I'm amazed by how many of us smoke, and I've been wondering what it might be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, shamanically it's, you know, I know people that if they're in ceremony, and it's a very bad ceremony, and lots of energy supply now, they'll be sort of smoking tobacco, and they'll see, oh, blow tobacco on their aura, saying something just landed on you, you know. That tobacco smoke just sort of moves it, you know.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Is that why the spirits like having tobacco left for them in ceremony, do you think?
I guess so, yeah. You know, I suppose they strengthen the spirit, don't they?
Yeah.
Of, like, plants, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, you put it next to a tree, and it's like tobacco is like an alloy of everything really. If you dry it somewhere, it'll soak up the aromas of this place. So if you dry it in a shed of cow manure, it'll start tasting. You smoke it, it'll taste like cow manure.
Yeah,
wherever, you know, it just absorbs everything.
Yeah, I know cannabis does that as well.
Right.
Pulls alkaloids out of the air. Okay. Anything that's around and volatile become part of the curing process.
Wow.
And you can completely trash it by burning an incense stick near it at the wrong moment.
Is it? Right.
Yeah, because it makes it taste really fragrant, which isn't exactly what you want.
Yeah.
What I'm hoping to do is just, because I've been looking at communities for all these years, and trying to see what works and what doesn't. And I thought it'd be nice to just unpack one or two of the common points we've discovered.
Sure.
So I might as well say that I've got them lucky enough to have Tamash with me, because otherwise I'll forget who it is I'm talking to. Thanks for joining me, Tamash.
No worries. Pleasure to be here.
Bit of a break in the pack down, so you'll be hearing the pack down going on in the background. We've got a few minutes together. In your talk on community, which we'll just have heard, in fact, by the time this comes out on the radio, you seem to suggest, and I tend to agree with you, that communities can come together really pretty well and evolve, but then there comes a point of involution. What did you mean by that exactly?
That first we look at the cycles of nature, things grow and develop almost by like mechanical laws, that when something starts, it has like a certain inertia, a certain kind of grace behind it. For instance, the spiritual path, they say everything starts with beginner's luck, and it ends with everyone being tested, you know, to the utmost.
Mm-hmm.
So when it's same with like a music band, everyone comes together and just all the ideas are there and it's exciting, it all forms. And the time something is formed, the thing which is formed suddenly is, if you like, that's like the peak of that cycle. And then by that same inertia, the same mechanicalness, it either turns into an institution, in which case the people are not necessary.
Yeah.
The people can come and go and you've just got an institution there.
Yeah.
The community, you know, it's people make the community, you know,
yeah.
It is the people.
Yes, you said that one of the things that happens is that people just become machines.
Mm-hmm.
When the community collapses, everybody does their own regular job,
right,
and nothing else. It's important that people work together, isn't it?
For sure, yeah. You know, and that's all group work as well, actually. Everyone working, for instance, one plot of land or building a house. I found the communities that work best is that when there's more communal work, there's less need for meetings. And where there aren't those things in place with communal work, there are a lot more meetings, and the meetings drag on.
Yeah.
And when you're working together, it takes away the necessity for that.
People communicate, don't they, whilst they're working, so ideas travel naturally.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, industry was just sort of catching up with that kind of idea in the early 90s. They were starting to write management manuals called things like Thriving on Chaos.
Right.
And they were saying that, you know, decisions need to be made as people pass each other in the corridor. And that everybody needs to have enough information to be able to make the right decision when their moment comes. And that strikes me as would be quite useful skills to develop in a community.
Sure. It's like got this almost like organic socialism, where like everyone's involved, everyone's participatory.
Yeah.
And yet in the system, I mean, from the 90s, it seems like almost a dream, a ghost dream of what you just mentioned there, and how everything, all the decisions need to be made behind closed doors.
Mm.
We don't know who's going to be the person that is selected, who we then elect, you know.
Mm.
For instance, it's all, you know, it's beyond our level of control, participation.
Yeah. And I guess if you've got a community that's running where, you know, as you put it, one man's collecting the wood, one man's doing the cooking, what you tend to start doing if somebody wants to leave is look to replace the job.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're living as a community that's working together, as you say, and not having meetings, then an individual that moves on will substantially change the place, as will the next individual that comes along.
Mm-hmm. I suppose everyone adds their strength, everyone, you know. And many times people come to a community and they don't know what their strengths are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the society we've sort of been trained, and even from our, you know, the way we've been raised up, that there's sort of an emphasis of not expressing ourselves artistically, or a lot of our real powers are sort of hidden in our weaknesses.
Yeah.
And the things which we think we're strong with are actually our weaknesses.
Yeah.
And often there's this need for everyone to hold people who come to the community, and then in order for them to flourish, and then they see what tools they can give.
Yeah.
You know?
And communities, I mean, I find it normally a very good place for finding the space to explore your own creative abilities and what you can do best. And you get a chance to learn lots of new things to try your hand at as well, don't you?
Yeah, you do, you know. It's that sort of natural coming together and skill sharing. And you got no certificates about it, you know, at the end of it. And, I mean, the communities that sort of came a bit chaotic are the ones that people came, and everyone's straight away wanted to manifest and wanted to do what they wanted to do. You know, I want to build like a cob oven, and when one person builds something, they leave, other people come, and what they built may have been in the wrong place, and suddenly you have loads of stuff, lots of tat.
Yeah.
And these little things sort of accumulate to kind of like a lack of focus.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
Like the less you have, the less you need, the easier life is. You know?
Yes.
And really, the communities that work are the ones where the people who come new, and they're literally, you know, carrying the buckets of manure.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing the compost, they're doing the real things, you know, hands in the earth.
Learning how it works, which I think that's a good way as well, because something I've noticed about established communities is that sometimes you have more or less a complete change in personnel, as it were, and the new people, say 10, 15, 20 years down the line, have got no knowledge of why things are being done the way they are, because the development process doesn't get carried forward.
Right.
And if you start by doing, as you say, the jobs at the root of the thing, you will, as you do those, learn about why it is they're done the way they are, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It, one common aspect in, for instance, the tribes and communities in Latin America is that they have, I suppose to say, they're fortunate or ourselves unfortunate that they've inherited this sort of spiritual lineage from their culture. And in our culture here, that's been like bludgeoned out of us.
Yeah.
And in order to replace that, not necessarily replace it in an artificial sense, but walk through the paces to get that back up. A lot of ceremony is like a magical aspect in the community, you know, to form something.
Yeah.
Be it a sweat lodge or be it some sort of Native American or something which sort of connects to that indigenous ray.
You clearly regard some kind of spiritual core activity as absolutely essential to longevity of community.
Right. I mean, something that I sort of said in the talk, which I don't mind repeating here for people to sort of get it more established, is that the idea of community is that we want to change the system, we want to change things. And obviously there's a sentiment now that we must start with ourselves, that it's impossible to try and exchange the external world, and if we are the causes of it, then we're taking the power back in our hands. It's like in the system, the system was not made by us. You know, the system was made, as they say, like the web wasn't made to catch the spider, you know. And whilst we're in the system trying to fight them at their game, it's like playing chess with someone who's inventing the rules as it goes along.
Absolutely.
You move a chess
correct.
Piece and says, no, you can't do that because, you know, and his pieces are slightly different.
Yeah.
You know, and what you said about the trust laws, this is almost playing them similar on their own game. They can't start changing their own laws with the trust laws. But the tools that we have on our side are love, fraternity, equality, all these human virtues, and those are our powers, and we need to cultivate those.
And they attract things to us in the real world that are in resonance with those ideals, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
I think another thing that's important to bear in mind is that I remember when I was talking to people at Occupy in London, that several of them said that their lives had been really boring before they got there, that they were doing the same stuff day after day, and that they were really enjoying the novelty of challenge that was arising down there for whatever reason.
Right.
So that each day was being approached with enthusiasm, you know. Right. And I think that community can, because people are doing new things, it can fire up enthusiasm, which can completely revivify people.
Right, sure. No, that's interesting, because one part of the community that when things go stagnant is when it comes too closed, then it's almost like you have that illusion that we're all awake, but actually we're just all dreaming that we're awake.
Yeah.
And having this sort of connection with the outside world and doing something to help the larger community, it's like the cell is like a community of different, you know, different aspects in that cell, the nucleus, the membrane.
Yeah.
And yet that cell is only there to serve an organ or to serve the body.
Yeah.
And so it's necessary for that community also to find ways that it can hold its energy, hold its space, but also how it feeds into the larger community.
Because again, dealing with the larger community is an absolutely essential part. Otherwise, I think that's the difference between commune and community in my mind.
Right, sure. Yeah, commune is like quite close, and the whole communism, how they sort of cut it off. The socialism that came in Latin America, it was much more about, it wasn't that the state owned the land, the people had the chance to, the people were given the land to look after.
Yeah.
You know, and that was, you know, that's what the earth wants.
Yeah.
Is that the people to be connecting with the land again, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and it seems to be happening. Another thing you said that I found particularly attractive is that when we encounter challenge with other individuals, that that is an opportunity for greater strength in the relationship. I think it's something that's not noticed by the world of the world management team, but I've seen it happening myself. Would you like to say a bit more about that?
Sure, you know, and you live in a town or a city or a place where there's just so many interactions, if you have a problem with someone, you can sort of automatically dismiss it and say, well, that's because they're in such and such a state. Then you go off and you may not see them for a few weeks, few months, and then that problem is patched over. And then maybe a few years down the line, that little problem that you had that you never dealt with in that moment, suddenly through all those layers and all those experiences, you never really get to flourish that connection with that person. But if those situations arise and you're living with that person, you're eating with that person, you're sleeping in the room, you know, next to that person, it's so in your face, that problem, that it's a case that you do have to learn how to deal with it.
Mm.
And really it's a case, you know, of learning how to deal with those psychological shocks, you know, and not necessarily shocks in terms of like bumping into people, but actually, obviously, energetically, we all have this aura, and there are all many things in this aura, they're being sparked up and things are coming up through contact with people, you know, and there's old prophecies say that at some point there's going to be a planetary body coming to the earth. Maybe not, some say it will be a collision, some say it will just be an energetic collision. But if you like, that is almost like a, there's like a blueprint of these kind of psychological shocks we have with people.
Absolutely, you know? Brilliant, because one of the talks I was doing here was called Worlds in Collision and the Electric Universe.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
wow.
The people who are working in that field suggest that one of the problems we have is that we are living through the after effects of a planetary trauma which we're not being permitted to remember.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, we're kind of sublimating the behaviour of a whole race, and they say that if we could sort this out, it might be that we'd no longer have such lemming-like capacities.
Mm-hmm, sure. Yeah. This aspect of trauma is quite important because, you know, obviously we all each have our individual trauma in our own personal history, but actually as a culture, there are sort of cultural traumas as well.
Okay, I'll just say goodbye to Nolan.
Yeah, sure,
that's really great.
Right.
Yes, and the other thing, now that Nolan's gone, the other thing is that if you do have a... It seems to me that when people do have a prolonged opposition with each other, that once it is resolved, it results in a much stronger, much more loyal, much more trusting relationship than you would have got without the challenge.
Yeah, because in a sense, the problems we have with people, they're almost like the manifestation of these historical cultural problems. And so when you heal that, like, on a very personal level with people, you also heal the capacity to heal that, it like resonates out.
Yeah.
Once that's healed inside yourself, you're then able to help other people, you know, through that.
Yeah.
When you find people that come up to you in that energy, you're no longer identified with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And you can find ways of like connecting more with the heart with people.
Yeah.
Know? And not the issues.
And it is always a 50-50 thing, isn't it? No matter how often it appears to be the other entity who's been completely unreasonable, we're all 50% responsible for what it is that's happening to us. And I've said it a lot, that the only gift we have to bring the world is our own transformation, and that everything else will follow from that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Sure. No, I really resonate with that. There was a situation, not at this festival, it was another festival, where someone had saved me food, and I didn't come and pick it up. And when I did finally get to the kitchen, I asked if there was any food there. And the lady said no, and there was a man next to the lady. And when she said no, she said the truth, she threw it away. I felt bad for the fact that there's so many hungry people in this world, and from my own sort of lack of communication, my lack of, you know, like involvement, food got wasted.
Yeah.
And in that moment, I was kind of really upset. But obviously externally, the man didn't see that part, and just thought I was being really upset that my food was thrown away.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I got into a bit of an argument with this guy, and I felt a bit of injustice. I felt quite, you know, sort of upset by it. But when I later reflected on it and saw my own part in it, I saw, at the time, I felt myself to be like an immaculate white lamb, like I didn't do anything wrong, you know. But obviously it created a bit of a problem in the group, you know, and we needed to march forward, you know, as a group. And reflecting on that and going into the meditation, I saw that, yeah, obviously there was that 50-50 thing, you know. I had created that.
And does the meditation, because that also seemed to be a key thing in your talk, do you think that helps bring your mind to the parts of situations that you can change?
It's a step-by-step process, you know. Before often we go into a meditation, or when one starts, we sort of treat it almost like the control or delete on the computer. I remember someone saying, just switch off from the world. And yet we don't often go into like a lived experience with the meditation. If we
take something in that meditation as a means to for digestion, something to focus on, then we're also bringing in the concentration as well in that meditation, and we're sort of transforming something that after that meditation we can take back into, you know, back into the will. So rather than going control or delete, we're going control or delete, then going into the DOS system, the BIOS, and then sort of changing, you know, the software.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, very good. And it's I guess also we have a lot of barriers, don't we, on things that we're perceiving, and barriers that we have within which we feel it's safe to give and receive our version of love or whatever. And I guess the meditation, the returning to the stillness to an extent, drops some of those barriers.
Yeah. It's, I can't remember who said it, or someone connects with the Krishna movement. He said, if you want to, for instance, we're all like leaves on a tree. And it's one way, if you want to give love to someone, if you go up, you, like, love is like water. If you water that leaf, that water doesn't necessarily go into that leaf. They may not really accept that. But if you take it to the Supreme, to the roots of the tree, if you like, those roots are like the Supreme Being, you know, the being of which we're all a part of, you know, an organism, as well as the galaxy, the universe, you know, it's all a part of the Supreme Being.
Yeah.
If we cultivate a love for that, then it's a way of loving, you know, everyone and everything, but through that. But obviously, also, it's not... because we're all a part of that, it's ridiculous to love God but not love people.
Yeah.
You know, the two go hand in hand.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I always thought that love God and love your neighbour as yourself could broadly be translated as love everything and love all people.
Yeah. That's it, you know.
Yeah.
We're all one.
Yeah. Another thing that struck me that you said, which I thought was actually brilliant, because it's actually aligned with this idea of personal transformation being the only gift we've got, is that when a community collapses, as much as anything else, it's because some individual or individuals have stopped working, stopped participating, and become a dead weight, as if the movement of the community is completely reliant upon the continued movement and development of every single entity within it.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's, yes, that does happen. And it's necessary to know at what point, because sometimes people go through processes, and these processes, they can be a few weeks, sometimes they're for a few years. And it's necessary to have that visionary capacity to know whether that process is something which the community can hold, whether that process is something which they must explore in society. For instance, people have a problem with authority. In a community, if someone is, you know, not necessarily in an authority position, but they have responsibility that requires other people for their participation, if someone has a problem with that authority, occasionally it's a case that people must go into... to overcome that process, actually it's more serving for them to be out in the society, because with that problem with authority is our problem with our parents, and you know, and from that it's the whole historical thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes it can be unfolded in the community, but if those shocks aren't, if all the ingredients aren't there to, for that person to heal that problem, then sometimes it's necessary for that person to be in the society.
Yeah, and hopefully be alert enough to see the... to experience the lessons that are needed to be learned.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Sure. But prayer is a very big part as well of the communities that work, you know. And prayer, you know, it's like a word. It's sort of been sort of fairly kind of misunderstood, and it's sort of, one person described it as, please God give me that which I don't think I deserve, you know. Which sort of, that's this contamination, you know. But really prayer is like in communion with higher divine forces, you know, and this is something we should cultivate every minute, you know, every moment we should be in communication with some sort of force.
Yeah. And we also know, don't we, that how we feel about things and people around us affects them. This is not purely an internal matter, and so your prayer is effectively an expression of goodwill and compassion and desire for everybody else's happiness.
Yeah, sure.
And the other thing I thought was great is this idea of entertaining ourselves, because I'm with you all the way. I've experienced several times now where people get the opportunity without electronics and stuff to entertain each other, and it's always brilliant.
Yeah, sure. It when you haven't got the external society creating your entertainment, obviously you have to entertain yourself, and it creates like a whole... it sort of adds to the energy of the community, you know. I mean, society... or every single entity that's created, you know, it has its own, like, guardian angel. So Western society, with all its banks, and you look at a bank, it looks like a temple, you know. It's called, even the word
itself.
It
kind of is, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I've got some money for you.
Oh, thank you very much.
this tub with this.
That's most kind, thank you. I appreciate that,
Tuff.
I will hand it to the relevant authorities.
I appreciate the food, thank you.
That's great. Well, thanks for coming and supporting it. We appreciate
it. No, I really, really enjoyed it, and I really noticed the family, a bit of balanced family.
Mm. Brilliant.
And it was lovely. Thank
you. Great. So we'll be seeing you again then.
I hope so.
Great. It's fantastic.
They'll have me.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. You'll be more than welcome.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
It's symbolic, someone talking about banks and someone comes.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, yeah. I'll leave it in that bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, the banks do look like temples, and that's really what they are. You're giving them everything you've got because they're not obliged to give it back once you've handed it to them.
Yeah.
Isn't it? The other thing, kind of in closing, because I think the fun bit of it's really important, because one of the things I noticed about living in the world is that unless you're really careful about how things develop and unfold, you end up getting not proper food, not proper sleep, no fun. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've noticed about communities is that there is, in the ones that work, an emphasis on enjoying life together as well.
Yeah.
So although you said it is really hard work, and it is, mm-hmm. there's also space, isn't there, to develop your capacity for enjoying each other.
Sure. And it's something that can really extend out from like the couples. That if you think of a human being as created with a couple, man and woman, coming together, that is almost like the building block, like a unit, you know. So in the communities that I've seen out that I've worked, there's also quite a strong emphasis with like the couples. That the couples that are working in harmony, they often have more responsibilities in the community. Because from that relationship and that harmony, they're able to create other things as well, you know, and hold other people that may not be in that same place of strength.
I can see how that works because Jess and I have been working together now for probably the best part of 20 years, and I can see, although we share nearly everything and fight for who does the washing up rather than who doesn't and stuff, that there's a definite masculine and feminine tendency. Mm-hmm. So although we're doing the same things, we're doing them slightly differently, and it seems to supply somehow a more complete toolbox for dealing with the situation, whatever it is.
Yeah. The balancing of the masculine and feminine, it's just something quite necessary. Like, how do we balance that out? If you think about it in terms of community, if we're all trying to live as brothers and sisters, then it's necessary we have to have the same Father in heaven, have the same Mother Earth, and we have to see each other like brothers and sisters, and see each other as children, like feel like a child to those forces.
Yeah.
If we have the same parents, if we accept the Earth as our mother and the cosmos as our father, then we are brothers and sisters.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, brilliant.
I do very nicely, thank you, Thomas.
Okay, thank you very much.
It's Ben. Really great talk for the time. Nice. I look forward to seeing you again because that's
well, I hope so.
First. I know you've been around, but it's the first time we've actually met. Really.
Sure.
It's been a real pleasure.
Brilliant as well. Thank you very much.
Excellent.
And blessings to all of you here.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, I'm sure we're going to meet again somewhere.
I think so.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for your time.
Cheers, thank you.
That was Horace X and Mr. Sims Doesn't Like Us. Don't fight with tradition. That goes out to the Kitchen Posse, all of whom were at the Green Gathering with us. It was really great to see you all out in the field rather than lurking round the kitchen table, drinking coffee and sucking on olives. Tar for coming, guys. It was great to have you there. Well, next this evening, some of you will have noticed that whilst we were listening to Tomach, who, by the way, you could tell I really enjoyed talking to, what an amazing bloke. He's at once really cosmic and really down to earth, a really fantastic mixture, a great, great individual to chat to. But when he was doing his talk on shamanic community living, he was talking about the ayahuasca and the fact that it's made in a big cauldron and it mustn't be allowed to boil too much and it can't be let to go too cold, and all of that's got to happen for quite a long time. And it's got quite a lot of different things in it because it's necessary not only that it has the visionary substance, but it's got to have enzyme inhibitors put into it, which get rid of the human body's ability to prevent the visionary part of the plant from working on us and all of that. It's tremendously complicated, an amazing thing, which shamans say they were told about by the plant kingdom when they asked it. He mentioned the cauldron in connection with the cauldron. He mentioned Taliesin, which is a Welsh story about a cauldron. And as it happens, Synchro, known to you all by now, I'm sure, as somebody who comes on and chats with me quite frequently on the show, gave her version of the birth of Taliesin in the Nature Dome, which was part of the Avalon Rising estate for the Green Gathering. and I managed to get a recording of that as well. So I thought these things aren't just thrown together, you know. And also it's introduced by and played out by some of the quite spectacular weather we saw at the Green Gathering. It wasn't entirely dry. The other thing I think that's worth commenting on is that there was a wee youngster of some sort in the tent who seems to join in quite enthusiastically at fairly opposite points by and large, so I particularly enjoy that as well. So here we go. Here's Synchro doing her storytelling thing, just to go to show... Oh, what's happened there? Well, there we go. Just to show she's not just a pretty voice. Here we go.
Alive, I would be hewn from it, like a dream of stone, like Merlin, my brother in the hidden place. A feather in bright air, I drift in memory's disguise, shadowy as sunlight shaped by sea. At the time when King Arthur sat with his knights at the round table, there was a man named Tegid Voile. Now Tegid lived on the Sheen Peninsula in North Wales with an unusual family. Ceridwen, Tegid's wife, was known as Yr Hen Wrach, or the Old Witch. She was a powerful healer, but she could turn you into a toad or a hare, if you didn't do as she bid you. Now Tegid and Ceridwen had two sons, Morvran and Addagvi. Now Morvran was a cold young man of mean thoughts and dark places. He was lazy and stubborn. He used to sleep all day and only go about at night, scowling around in a bad mood. And he wasn't pretty. Come in. He was not a pretty sight. It was said that one glance from Morvran could smash a mirror to tiny pieces. But no one ever saw Addagvi. To witness the darkness in his soul was to lose the will to live. Some say that he knew death and that he'd been to the underworld. Well, Ceridwen preferred not to think about Addagvi at all. But she was very concerned about Morvran. How would he ever win favour at Arthur's court with his mean thoughts and dark outlook? What could she, Ceridwen, Yr Hen Wrach, do? She had an idea. She would find a spell that would give her son Morvran clear sight, poetic majesty, and knowledge of all that was, is, and will be. She would need a very powerful spell indeed. So, she took down her ancient magical books and scoured through them for 3 days and 3 nights until she found it. A magic potion that would give her son, or anyone who drank it, clear sight, poetic majesty, and knowledge of all that was, is, and will be. So Ceridwen brightened with enthusiasm for her new purpose. She ordered the blacksmith to cast a big cauldron to hold her magic brew. She forced an old blind man named Morda to chop the wood and tend the fire beneath the cauldron. She stole a young boy named Gwion Bach to stir the cauldron day after day, night after night, for a year and a day. So, as Ceridwen walked about the Sheen Peninsula, picking up the bits and pieces she needed for her magic brew, Gwion Bach stirred the cauldron. Morda, the old blind man, tended the fire beneath the cauldron. And Ceridwen often chanted this spell. Hurlum, burlum, hurly bum. Hurlum, burlum, hurly bum. Buriav heed ar y crochan hun. May magic to this cauldron come. Hurlum, burlum, hurly bum. Hurlum, burlum, hurly bum. Dow doi thineb trwy yr hyd hwn. May wisdom from this magic come. Hurlum, burlum, hurly bum. Hurlum, burlum, hurly bum. Morfran fydd trwy rym yr hyd. Y dyn doethaf yn y byd. By this magic, Morfran will be the wisest man in the whole world. So after a year and a day, Gwion Bach stirred. Morda was dog-tired. He'd fallen asleep on a pile of logs by the side of the cauldron. Gwion Bach stirred, and from where he stood, he could hear Morvran and Ceridwen snoring. So he stirred. And just at the very moment when the potion became ready, three magic drops, the only three magic drops in the whole brew, flew out of the cauldron and landed on Gwion Bach's finger. In that moment, Gwion Bach became wise. He had clear sight, poetic majesty, and knowledge of all that was, is, and will be. So he hid behind the bushes. And he heard Morvran and Ceridwen come rushing towards the cauldron. They'd woken up late. And as they arrived, the cauldron split into two with a wrenching scream. And the poisonous liquid oozed and bubbled away. Ceridwen knew straight away that her magic potion had gone. And she was livid. At first she thought Morda, the old blind man, was to blame. So she struck out his eye with a log. Morda, now double blind, managed to tell the old woman that it was Gwion Bach who stole your potion. Gwion Bach, by this time, had become so wise that he knew he had to flee from Ceridwen's anger. So he fled. He ran as a hare. She chased him as a hound. He swam like a small fish. She sped through the water like an otter. He flew as a small bird. She hunted as a bird of prey. He became small like a wheat seed. She became a big black hen who ate him. 9 months later, Ceridwen, yr hen wrach, gave birth to a beautiful baby boy. And she was charmed by him. She even said, "Coochie coo." "Coochie coo," spat Morvran. "That Gwion Bach stole my magic potion. He must die." So Ceridwen took the baby and sewed him into a leather sack. And threw the sack as far out into the sea as she could. And we are told that this happened on the 29th of April. the very moment the Caridwen threw the sack into the sea, a man further down the coast in Wales was having a brainwave. His name was Gwyddno Garanhir, or Gwyddno of the Long Legs. And he owned a fine stone weir on the coast. And this year he decided to give the bounty of his weir, which was famous for its large catch of salmon, especially on May Day Eve, he was going to give it to his wastrel son Elfin to see if he could make something of himself. So on May Day Eve, Elfin and his men waited down by Gwyddno's weir. They waited and they waited. The moon sailed over the sky, and finally the tide returned to the sea. But they were mortified to find nothing but mud and seaweed and a sea-soaked leather sack at the bottom of the weir. Where was their fine catch of salmon? So his men grumbled, but Elfin thought, well, I might as well go and see what I've got here. So he approached the leather sack, lifted it out of the mud, and opened it carefully. And inside, what did he find? It's a beautiful baby boy. Well, dyna Taliesin. And that's how Taliesin got his name, meaning radiant or shining brow. But then the baby spoke and told Elfin the story of his birth in fine poetry. And Elfin soon realised he'd found something far more precious than fish. So he took the baby, put it into the saddlebag on his horse, and rode home to show his father his magnificent catch. But when he got there, Gwyddno was disappointed. A baby? Where are the salmon? But then Taliesin spoke, and again he told the story of his birth in fine poetry. And amazed the old man. And Gwyddno told Elfin and his wife to take great care of this special baby. And they raised him well. In the rock, alive, I would be hewn from it, like a dream of stone, like Merlin, my brother, in the hidden place. A feather in bright air, I drift in memory's disguise, shadowy as sunlight, shaped by sea. Half in, half out, I am reborn. I am in the wood, I am in the stone. I am in the sun, I am in the dancing. I am in all things. This is my strength. This is my discovery. This, myself.